Hello and welcome to Ladies with Gumption, episode 28, Digging Up the Past. I am the person who is introducing you, aka your introductress, Tatiana, and I am here with
Jessica
and May.
And these lovely Ladies with Gumption are going to recap DCTV in a flash for you, except there's no flash this week. Now, you can find us on Twitter at DCTVGumption. Or you can email us nice, long, juicy emails at ladieswgumption@gmail.com or leave us a review on iTunes. So do one of those things. Enjoy. And finally, you can contact us individually on Tumblr. I'm Valerie M. Pettis. Jessica is falling in love in a flash. May is her own hero writer. And our handles do not show our bias at all. On to feedback. Iris asked Alan. She left a lovely ask on Tumblr and said she sent an iTunes review, but unfortunately, the reason we did not read it, aside from the fact that we didn't check iTunes because we didn't expect anyone to leave us a review, was that it is not there. I don't know. I think maybe iTunes ate our reviews. So if you left a review and haven't seen us read it, let us know and try submitting it again. But she does say she loved the podcast, which, thank you very much. We love you. And she agrees that AJK being gone and us finally getting Iris's journalism is no coinkadink. And I think we all agree with that, right? I think we've all determined that episode 14 was probably the last episode with major influence from him. And now we're seeing a slightly different vision, if not a huge change, because the story's already planned out. He did promise. Todd promised Fozia and I and Shamso at Heroes for Heroes, the beginning of Red Forest Season 4, he did say, this is the season where it's going to come back, and it did not come back.
Yeah, and we called you liars.
Yeah, we called you liars, and now here it is. Here it is. He fulfilled his promise. Thank you, Todd. Anyway, we've also got an email from Yvonne, who loved episodes 15 and 16 of The Flash and wanted to gush. And we did a lot of gushing, too, so we understand. About episode 15, it was the best of the season, for sure. Felt completely comic booky in the best way, with high stakes and Grant acting his butt off. And after a mid-season slump, it reminded her why she loves the show. Again, totally agree. Even though it was a standalone, she said 15 shows what good writing for a story is, and that maybe Flash could do better without 23 episodes. So, I mean, yeah. It would be better if they had fewer episodes. But unfortunately, everyone's got to get paid. So they can't do that. As about episode 16, she said, it's crazy how it took 4 seasons to get to the sidekick love interest comic book trope, getting powers for a day. I agree. But then again, Lois didn't get it until the episode before the season series finale. So,
that's true.
A little bit better. She loved the Purple Lightning. And she loves seeing Iris' hair in a ponytail, as well as casual Iris at the end. That's like the most hairstyle she's had all season.
She has 3 different hairstyles in 1 episode. That's like a record.
Shocking.
Yeah, she agrees with us on all that we loved, and that it was a missed opportunity for a smaller Purple Flash mission or cute moments, like getting up and getting dressed faster than Barry, and a Frost Lady Flash team up. So yeah, she had lots of Jessica's points. And Jessica wrote that in all caps because she agrees very much. And yes, it would have been more hashtag feminism than just the 2 you go girls or that's right girl or whatever. Frost was sorry.
But it is the most enthusiasm she's shown, right? She's usually like a negative Nelly, so hey, progress.
Yeah. She's like positive Polly this time.
That's a good one. Final highlight is the return of Reporter Bay. Totally agree. Right there with you. Media needs more representation of Black female journalists, for sure. And Iris can do, as a journalist, what Barry can't as a speedster. Expose injustice, whistleblow through journalism. Totally. Justice and truth. Yes. It's like it says in the Flash comic, he's justice and you're truth. And that's why they work so well together. Would anyone like to share Kendra's email?
Yeah, so Kendra emailed us. She also enjoyed 15-16. Thank you, Kendra, for your email, first of all. It was nice and long, just how we like them. And she has a Caitlyn slash Frost theory. One of them is she secretly working with DeVoe. So the gist of it is that she thinks that Caitlyn slash Killer Frost may be working with DeVoe and becoming a villain for next season or leaving at the end of the season. And she highlights several different pieces of evidence from the premiere of season 4, from 4-5, 4-6, 4-7, and 4-15, and basically says that since Killer Frost, or since Caitlyn doesn't remember what Killer Frost is doing in her spare time, she could be hanging out with DeVoe. And general observations is that Killer Frost doesn't have any motivations and that all the characters are glossing over Caitlyn's meta-human selling past. So even though the Caitlyn Killer Frost storyline has been a mess, which it has been, that if they try to get Killer Frost to be working with DeVoe, that could kind of like up her storyline. And while I personally think all of these theories are really great, I don't think that the writers, A, love Caitlyn enough and are smart enough to want to pull off these storylines for her, which is unfortunate because at this point I'll take more development for Caitlyn than for Ralph, but that's a completely separate story.
I feel like all of the points that she brought up, like in different episodes, like for example, in the premiere, she was saying that how did Caitlyn know the bears in the Speed Force? And right. The only people that knew that were the people that were still on Team Flash and Team DeVoe. So either she's on like one of those teams. If it wasn't Team Flash, maybe it was Team DeVoe. But I think that's just like plot holes and lazy writing and not really like a secret twist. And I feel like at this point, they've already done like Caitlyn betraying the team slash Killer Frost betraying the team and going with Savitar, that if they do it again, I would just be like more frustrated with it because they keep flip-flopping.
They're still not willing to go all in. Like, they have their toe in the water, but they don't want to give her, they don't want to make her a quote-unquote killer, you know, because that's part of her name, but they haven't really jumped in to that
story. Like, if she is like working for DeVoe, that would be like the biggest plot twist ever. And we would give Kendra, like, all the props in the world.
Yeah, all the awards.
All the awards.
You get if all it had already happened, then it would be great. But, like, all right, I guess they could do it, like, she was never good to begin with. She never decided to go good. And it's all been fake. But that would be...
It would undercut a combo with Ralph in 4-6 or whatever.
Yeah, it would be an upsetting story in a way that's not necessarily good storytelling, you know? I don't know. I mean, I guess it could be like Ward and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. season 1. So like, but because this is season 4, it's different, you know? Yeah. It really changes who Caitlyn is as a character. So
yeah.
I don't know. They could do it. I wouldn't put it past them to do it, but I don't think it's where they're going right now. Especially now that we've heard the whole thing about Harry and the thinking cap maybe turning him bad. Yeah. You can't have more than one turning bad.
And I feel like
Dawn didn't like either of them when she saw them, so no.
And I feel like Caitlyn's storyline moving from this point forward will be more about like supporting Harry or being there for Harry, because I feel like that's they would rather go.
They have definitely been mining that dynamic for sure.
But she did mention a good point was that, you know, in 4-7, they showed the scene with Caitlyn and E.O. Wells, and then Caitlyn hears DeVoe's name, but then she doesn't remember who he is in present time. If this is a twist, that would be something major, but I'm not sure that that's where they want to go with her. But thank you for sending your email. That's lovely, lovely theories. Much smarter than the writers can ever do for Caitlyn.
If anybody else wants to weigh in on this Caitlyn theory, feel free to let us know.
Yeah, please send your email or your tweets about it. Next up is our Krypton premiere, thoughts and feelings. So we ran a poll on Twitter, and 40% of you guys were wait and see on whether or not you were going to tune into the show. And since May had already seen and gave you some thoughts, now myself and Jessica will tell you whether you should wait or see. But first, because after just one episode, some fans are struggling to connect with a black woman white man pairing, which is so unusual, that means it's time for everyone's favorite game show, I'm Not Racist, But, where we guess reasons why fandom just can't get behind a particular interracial pairing. Seg from Krypton. Our two guests are May and Jessica. So, May, please complete the sentence. I'm not racist, but...
The love interest is a black woman, and I can't self-insert, so the canon couple the plot is telling me to ship is boring.
That's right, May. Regarding Lita and Seg, there's already those in the fandom that feel that the classic warring family's tragic love, Romeo and Juliet trope, is boring, and they'd rather watch the totally not played out, never before seen in fanfiction or on screen, enemies to lovers, arranged marriage trope. Jess, are you ready for your turn?
I'm ready.
I'm not racist, but...
They just feel like brother and sister to me. I don't see chemistry.
Ding, ding, ding! That's right! There's already some concern that Lita and Seg just, like, feels like a family bond. Sometimes you like seeing your brother or sister in handcuffs, and you like to have secret sex with them, and that's just totally normal. It's just very, very different from the interesting and new dynamic between Nyssa and Seg, who will be adopted into her family and forced to be her husband, even though they don't even like each other. And her father had his grandfather killed. So that's just really what we crave to see as audience members. Next round is worth twice the points. Not that we ever saw how many points we got before, but everyone wins in this game. May, tell us. I'm not racist, but...
I want to see the black woman as independent and more than just a love interest.
This one is one of my favorites, May, and I'm so glad you got it right. Because it's like, when a black woman is a love interest, we can't see them as a complete human being. Because all we can see is the white man she's taking from us. Instead, we have to see her develop on her own, totally isolated, without support, so that then we can feel bad for her. As opposed to the white girl who doesn't have to do anything and can be with the white man, and that just feels like a complete story. I don't know. I don't know why that is. All right. Jessica, I'm not racist, but...
The white girl's just so much more interesting already. She has so much agency.
That's also great, because Nyssa absolutely decided that she wanted to marry Seg, so she has agency, right? But... Lita, who decided that she was still going to be with Seg, even though she can't be, doesn't have agency. It's probably just the plot making her want to be with Seg. It's really interesting how that works out. So because of that, we should 100% make Nyssa the love interest, because that is going to be totally different from Lita being the love interest. And that's all we have time for on I'm Not Racist But, where no one wins, but we all lose brain cells.
Yeah.
And for the record, Jessica wrote that line. So good job, Jessica. That was beautiful. You know, I have to say, I don't know why I didn't expect it. Because I should have, because there is a white woman, and she is a potential love interest, so I should have known that it was going to go there. But somehow I just thought, when two people are supposed to be together but don't want to be, usually you know that you want to root for what the person actually wants.
For actual Krypton thoughts on what we thought about the episode, like, I feel like, May, do you say you gave it like a 6 or a 7 out of 10 for the pilot? Like, yeah, what did you rate?
I gave it a 6 as my final rating.
Yeah, I think that's not, I would agree with that, and I think that's not bad for a sci-fi pilot episode, because sci-fi usually has some, like, weak pilot episodes. But I thought that it was visually really nice. It was a little bit boring or slow at sometimes in the plot, but, you know, pilots, you have to do a lot of exposition, so that makes sense. Like, the obvious OTP that we discussed is, like, Lita and Seg, but there is a white woman, there is Nyssa, and technically, she's legally binded to procreate with Seg, so nonsense is not completely off the table, as we just discovered in our little game show. But I think that, and I'll have to go back and rewatch the pilot to, like, confirm, but when I was watching it, it seemed like the story was centering around Seg, Superman, and Lita and Seg together. So, like, whenever Seg had, I think the first time that the guy from the future approaches Seg about the Superman, Save Superman plot, is after the first time he and Lita interact. So you see, like, guy in the background being kind of shady, and why is he wearing a Detroit cap? I don't understand. This is Krypton. What is happening? But then, like, when you finally get your first scene with Lita and Seg, she releases him, and then almost immediately he runs into Detroit Cap guy and tells him about saving Superman. And then after the second scene with Lita and Seg, when they're, like, sleeping together and he has to escape with his mom, they go to the Fortress of Solitude and bring up, like, the Superman thing again. And then after the third time that they have a scene together and he leaves and he needs to go to the Fortress of Solitude, Detroit Cap guy is there again, bringing out the saving Superman plot. So in my mind, and what I'm thinking is, like, the show is kind of subtly telling you that these three things are connected. So we'll see how that kind of develops, obviously, as the show goes on to, you know, who Jor-El's mother is supposed to be. And I want to say that it's still the end game for the simple fact that Shakespearean-wise, having this be, like, a very DC thing to do for Lita to be Jor-El's mother, and then enemies, Superman and Zod, are actually, like, cousins, and they didn't know it or something like that. The same way that Barry and Cobalt Blue, Malcolm Vaughn, were actually, like, twins, and, you know, Bart is also related to Eobard because through his mother. So, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibility for that to be something that DC does, and I am going to stick with that theory as far as the show goes. In other areas of the episode, I thought that, I forget, what is Lita's mom's name?
Allura.
Oh, they changed to Jaina. It was Allura, and they changed it to Jaina. Yeah, I was confused while watching because they kept calling her Jaina, and so then I was like, are there two different characters, and I just can't tell them apart? But no, it is, Allura is now Jaina.
Oh, sure.
And I think they did that because Kara's mom is named Allura.
Yeah.
So they probably thought that was two.
She's similar?
Yeah.
Well, I like that she seems like a strong character. Like, she's very physically strong and a little bit unyielding, and her dynamic with her daughter is a little bit, like, weird. Don't really know how that's going to, like, play out, but there's probably more to her than meets the eye, and the kind of, like, soft moments, like, when she sees Seg, where he's not supposed to be, and she doesn't, like, arrest him immediately, and I low-key think that it kind of sucks because she did kill his parents. But I think that the reason why she did that, there's more to that. Like, she didn't want them to have to go through the whatever.
Yeah, I definitely believed.
Yeah.
When they approached her, they're like, that was, like, an act of mercy. Like, you did it, like, and especially because she starts off saying, like, no mercy.
But she killed the mercy.
Yeah, and I would say their dynamic is more interesting in the second episode because you get much more of it, and then you see how Jaina reacts when Lita has, like, a character development in a way that changes the way she acted in the pilot.
Interesting.
Yeah.
May with the teaser. I love it.
Very cryptic.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only other thing that I didn't like was that they were just, like, super British accents. And it was just, like, throwing me off. Like, all the mates and all that kind of stuff. Like, this is an alien planet. At least try to sound like you're not from
Britain. Yeah, I agree with you guys on, like, the six kind of rating. Like, it's not a show that I'm telling, like, have to tell all my friends to watch, you know? But it was a solid premiere. I thought it did a really good job of, like, building the world and how it, like, it still feels like Earth, but there's, like, little aspects that are different so that you can, you know, you feel like you're on Krypton. And it looked visually good. Like, literally speaking, it had really great visuals. You could see that they put a lot of time and effort into that production design. And it wasn't, like, super dour like DCEU is, but also wasn't, like, campy and light like DC TV is. So it is, like, a nice little blend in the middle. Because I definitely was expecting it to be super dark. The world's ending, gotta save my grandson. But they had a lot of, like, light heart, like, levity, especially with Kem and Adam Strange, which was good. And Seg, actually, like, his behavior was very, like, he's, like, trying to be a bad boy or whatever. So there was, he was an enjoyable character. No one really, like, super invested in anything yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing how it goes. And I thought that the acting was very strong. I really liked, the chemistry between Georgina and Cameron. I thought that it really, like, they believably felt like a couple that were already in love. You know, I liked that they did like enough establishing work with that, I think. I think the character that intrigued me the most was actually Seg-El's mom, and then she just got murdered. And that was too soon for me. Like, his parents dying was too soon. I don't know. I feel like they could have held off on that a little bit. Maybe it could have been the very end of episode one.
Like, save it for episode two.
Yeah.
He already lost
his grandfather. Exactly. Beginning of episode, he lost his grandfather. You can deal with that, and then episode two, or like, the very end of episode one could have been them getting arrested. you know, and then we see the trial part of it too. But whatever.
I was just upset because I'm like, really? You're going to kill the parents again? Like, how many DC TV shows do I have to watch where the parents just die? Come on.
At least this time the dad died too. All right? You know?
And he died right. First.
Yeah. Progress.
Yeah. I did find the Jaina and Lita dynamic intriguing. Is it Lita or is it Lita?
I think it's Lita.
Sorry, guys. Lita. Like, it makes me want to, like, put my lighters in the air. Anyway, okay. So, Jaina and Lita's dynamic was really intriguing, and I'm looking forward to seeing how it, like, either they, like, clash, or, like, does Jaina soften towards her, or, like, how are these women going to become the House of Zod that we know that is so violently anti what the House of El stands for? It'll be interesting. I also, in terms of Segel's love life, while I'm not as convinced that it'll be like a quote unquote happy end where they'll like get to be together and make the babies that will become Jor-El and then eventually Clark, I definitely don't think Nyssa is going to be the mom. Like, I feel like I could rule her. I mean, like, just because when that little whatever thing, the procreation, the progeny revealer, whatever you want to call it, yeah, was, I can't remember. I thought they said a name, but Jessica's saying they did not say a name. I felt like they said a name and it did not end with L, and I was like, so, because he's not, if he's with
yeah,
her,
yeah, they call him Vex.
He can't take his own name if he's with her. The point is that he's going to be adopted into her house.
Right.
So I was like, so obviously that's not what happens. End of story. We know that they're not going to end up together.
We solved it.
Their son would be like a lawyer or something like that. And Jor-El's, and I think Jor-El's in like the science field or something. Yeah.
Jor-El's in the science guild, and he has a brother, Kor-El, who is Kara's father. So, clearly, Nyssa is not the womb factory that that she should be. So, bye, Nyssa. Anyway, I definitely wasn't, like, I thought it was funny when she was like, oh, you're not repulsive, and then it was, you know, when she was like, oh, I actually have my own plan for why I want to marry you. But it's not like she liked him. It sounds like she has her own devious plan for why she wants to marry him.
Spoiler alert, she doesn't have a plan. At least not up until, like, where I've watched.
she doesn't have a plan?
No. Oh, okay. And it's funny to me because, like, to add on, because my thoughts the last time were very vague. I just felt like she was, I don't know what it was, but the actress who plays Nyssa, like, it's like she herself didn't quite know whether she was supposed to be this deviant, like, plotting person on the side, or whether she was just supposed to do what her dad was supposed to tell her, you know? So I can't quite figure out where she stands at this point, and it's throwing me off.
And how many episodes have you seen now?
I've only seen the two, so.
Oh.
I shall watch the third one this weekend.
Okay, so yeah. So I'm not particularly like, I don't really care what she's up to right now. We'll see. I'm not like against her. I don't have a problem with her right now, because she's just doing what she gotta do, just like everyone else. But I'm not. I don't have particular feelings.
Yeah.
I am definitely, though, I loved Adam Strange. I thought that Sean Sippo did a really great job. So I look forward to seeing more of him and just sort of getting that connection to the present through him. Mm-hmm. And Brainiac looked so good. Like, shocked by how good Brainiac looked. Like, I really believe that that could be a good big bad. Just, you know, judging the book by its cover. I was like, all right, I'm on board with that.
Same. Upgrade from the Supergirl Brainiac.
Yeah. He's so sweet, he's so cute, but it's not the same because he's not a villain. It's just, you know, it's not the same. And then final point is just Barristan Selmy was the grandfather, and I can't believe I had to watch him die again, but thankfully he's very clearly the Jor-El of this series, so we will see him in hologram form, and I will know that Ian McKellen is getting his paycheck. All right.
Oh, but I will add, for those anybody can quote-unquote concerned about Lyta and her storyline, she does have one outside of Seg, so she can have that and a romance, and it's okay to those who are truly worried.
We love our concerned trolls.
All right, so now on to side A, even though that probably feels to you like it was a side A.
It really was.
We are going to be doing Legends of Tomorrow and Black Lightning reviews, so you know the drill. Talk about our likes, talk about our dislikes, predicting our season predictions, and then crowning our Lady of the Week. And after that, we're going to do a side B, with requested fandom topic from our lovely Nessa, West Ellen Allure, who asked us to talk about fandom shipping. The good, the bad, and the ugly of shipping non-canon pairs in fandom. So, without further ado, May is going to go through the Legends of Tomorrow recap on Side A, Calm Before the Storm / GTC. Take it away, May!
In what is really Side B at this point, Legends of Tomorrow. The episode opens with Sarah and Ava in bed when Sarah wakes up from a nightmare of a girl taunting her on the ship. Ava confronts Sarah and Sarah calls Ava her girlfriend, but Ava immediately feels all kinds of jealous over the fact that Sarah and Constantine totally hooked up 3 weeks ago in 1969. Sarah tells Ava to let it go, but of course Ava cannot. The couple is interrupted from their cuteness when they're informed that the anachronisms are getting worse. The team gathers and Sarah decides to split everyone up so they can take on each of these anachronisms by pairs, all in different time periods. But before any of them can leave the ship, Sarah is called by the death totem and her old Black Canary self reveals herself to taunt Sarah to grab the totem. Black Canary Sarah urges White Canary Sarah to take hold of the death totem, convincing her that she can control the power herself and then can bring the dead back too. Sarah isn't able to resist the urge and takes hold of the totem, taking out poor Ray first. The team is alerted to this nonsense, but before they can take Sarah out, the possessed leader locks them into the medbay. Wally, using his speedster abilities, is able to phase his hand through the locks and open the door, where he goes after Sarah himself. Before he can get to her, though, he comes face to face with a physical manifestation of Jesse and his insecurities. Jesse tells him he's basically worthless, that he's only the son of a drug addict, and that he's a speed junkie who's basically less than her. Wally then fights Sarah and gets taken out. Next up is Zari, who has to confront the apparition of her brother in an emotional confrontation, knows that he's not real, has to say goodbye to him, but it doesn't make it any easier for her. But right after the apparition disappears, Sarah knocks Zari out too. Nate finds Wally, and since Amaya doesn't have her totem and can't wield another, Nate finds the Earth totem and wears it. He finds Sarah, but not before he has to confront his dead grandfather, Commander Steele, who tells him Amaya is too good for him. Sarah then beats the shit out of Nate, leaving Amaya to have Mick wield the fire totem, which was reactivated by Nate using the cold fusion process in order to stop Sarah. Using the fire of the totem, he knocks Sarah out. While the external fighting is happening on the ship, Sarah is fighting from inside the spirit world. She's unable to leave it, but can hear her friends' voices on occasion. Nora Dark appears to try and convince Sarah to join the dark side, claiming that she can't find Mollus. She can't fight Mollus forever. Sarah then has to face some of her own darkness with a scene of her shooting a man in cold blood back when she was a member of the League of Assassins. Meanwhile, Ava has gone on the hunt for John Constantine. He's the only one who would be able to snap Sarah out of her possession. When Constantine and Ava try to untrap Sarah's soul, Mollus locks them out. But the power of true love comes to the rescue when Ava tells Sarah to come back and come home to her, and she does. Later, Sarah is afraid of what living the half-life Nora suggested could mean and breaks up with Ava because there's apparently too much darkness inside Sarah for a healthy relationship to work. She's damaged goods. This leaves Ava heartbroken, and she leaves, for now. Sarah apologizes to the team, and Gary starts a new game of Dungeons & Dragons with Constantine, and that's what you missed on Legends of Tomorrow.
That Dungeons & Dragons party, I totally missed that.
You did!
It was awesome.
So, ladies, what did we like about the episode?
I thought that Avalanche was really cute in this episode, and you can definitely tell that there's the shift that's going on in the writer's room from Still Vixen being, like, the anchor ship to Avalanche being the new anchor ship, which makes sense because Sarah is, like, the de facto lead, so obviously she should have, like, the lead ship. I thought the girlfriend conversation was really cute. Although, like, Sarah, like, at the end, Sarah's like, it was the first time that she's really been happy, and I'm just like, Katrina Law says hello, because Nessa probably looks back, like, the hell. I also like seeing Ava so concerned about Sarah's well-being to the point that she reluctantly even teamed up with John, even though she finds him, like, kind of repulsive, to get Sarah back, because he was their best shot. Her jealousy towards John is really funny because they're just, like, polar opposite people. She's very, like, uptight and orderly, and he's just very, like, laid back and does whatever he wants to do. Probably my favorite part of them together was when she, like, barges into his circle because she's going to the demon world, if he's going to the demon world to get Sarah, and he asks to hold hands, and she just, like, gives him, like, a little finger. Like, I don't want to touch you. You seem dirty, but here's my finger. And then, of course, following the book of True Love, TM, Ava is the one that brings Sarah back from the brink, which is also to protect you. It's not you, it's me, kind of brooding hero excuse for Sarah to break up with Ava. So, like, it's following, even it's kind of cool because these are a ship of two women, but it's still following the same. I don't know if that's cool or if it's, at least it's that's what I mean. Because even though they're two women, she's still following the same brooding hero playbook that you would see, like, a Batman or someone. Sarah's the new Batman. Take that, Oliver Queen. Anyway, what else did I like? Oh, the only other thing I like out of all the apparitions that showed up to torment the people on the ship, I thought Zari's scene with her brother was the most emotional, and I like that one the most. We all know, like, how much that relationship means to her, but actually being able to see them together was really heartbreaking. And the kid that played her brother is Patrick Savignoni's son.
Oh, that's so cute.
So he got his first acting credit with Zari on Legends of Tomorrow, so that's cool.
Oh, that's adorable.
That's really great.
Yeah, and then I also liked Nora showing up in the demon realm to try and, like, convince her to join, like, the dark side, which, haha. And then structurally how they set up the episode, Gary with his Dungeons and Dragons, like, telling a story, and then, like, seeing that paralleled with what's actually going on in the ship, with all the legends having their own Dungeons and Dragons character and telling the story through that, I thought was a really good parallel or, like, visual representation. So I liked all those elements.
Yeah, I as y'all know, I liked everything that you liked. But yes, I definitely love the Dungeons and Dragons thing. It was a lot of fun. Gary just really brings a nice levity to the show in a different way than the other legends, right? Because, like, he doesn't, like, fit on the team. He's not a legend, but he feels tonally appropriate. So yes, I very much enjoyed his, and then having the little Dungeons and Dragons party with, or, you know, having your own little campaign with Constantine was fun. It's like another indicator that he is going to be around more, and now we know he's going to be an actual regular next season. So Constantine himself, once again, he brings a great energy to the show. It's obvious that he meshes well, and now we got to see him mesh with Ava, or clash with Ava rather, but it's a great and energetic exchange that if they both stick around next season, we're going to get to see a lot more of that kind of clash, especially because he's so much like Sarah. I really loved the bedtime, or, you know, morning nightmare, whatever you want to call it, scene between Sarah and Ava, and how they've nicely moved into this new dynamic where, you know, they're explicitly romantic and Sarah can be honest with things like the fact that she slept with Constantine a couple of weeks ago. Even if Ava is jealous, it didn't feel like, you know, it's that serious. Like, she can tell her the truth and Ava can be jealous, but it's still, like, the important thing is Sarah's calling her girlfriend now, and, like, they're gonna be official, even though it lasted a very short amount of time. And while I know that you're feeling like, oh, well, what about Nyssa, like, when suggesting that Sarah is happy, right, for the first time, or this is the happiest she's been in a while, like, I feel like she's also, it's not just Ava versus Nyssa, but, like, she is a hero now, right? Like, she's fighting for something that she believes in, and she's not, like, an assassin murdering people for the League. So, so I feel like that helps to contribute to the happiness, and that's why the darkness of remembering her past as an assassin makes it impossible for her to continue with the happiness of the relationship, although I have issues with that. But I did like the way that thematically that tied together and how all of them were sort of facing whatever they were afraid of. I thought was good. That's what the demon does to you, right? It makes you sort of, like, not necessarily face the worst parts of yourself, but, like, feel like that's all that you have are the worst parts of yourself. I thought the mindscape, you know, whatever you want to call it, of Mollus haunting Sarah was genuinely scary. Like, this was, like, the first time that I felt like, oh, Mollus is a threat. Like, Mollus can do some fucked up shit, which before I was just like, whatever. What is a Mollus? Who cares? So I'm glad that felt better. And I liked seeing the reminders of what Sarah used to do and who Sarah used to be, because it's so easy to forget what her roots are in the show and, like, where she came from, because she feels so different now. And also, I liked that she was able to fight off Mollus, you know, she was emotionally strong enough to do it in the moment, even if later she kind of backtracked. Nora, again, yeah, Nora coming, like, trying to bring her over to the side was interesting. It helps make more sense of, like, what Malus wants, right? Like, it's not because he was afraid of the totems, or Nora Soundless was afraid of the totems for him, but, like, he just doesn't want totem bearers on the good side. He wants if he could get the totem bearers to turn bad, then that would be great for him. So again, that helps establish more of what he's looking for and what his goal is. Tala Ash has been such a great addition. Like, she keeps impressing every week. She brings Zari up another notch. So that moment with her brother was for sure the most emotional moment of the episode for me. And I would never have guessed that was that little kid's first acting credit. So you go, Stabby Jr. But yeah. It was such a sweet and sad moment. And also, he was so little that I'm like, is that how young he was when he died? Or is that just, like, how she remembers him? Because he can't even be that young. He was actually, like, a...
I think he was an adult. I think that was... Yeah. When he was, like, younger.
Yeah. But like, to bring him back to, like, the time, because it's, like, I think what it says to me is, like, feels guilty for not being able to protect him. So, like, seeing him as, like, a helpless child is more, like, hammers at home, if you want to say. So, yeah, I love that a lot. And yes, Ava going to get Constantine to save her bae was great. I loved the dynamic, and I loved how it just showcased how much Ava cares about Sarah and how far she's willing to go and what she's willing to put up with. And then finally, I did like sort of Amaya helping Mick with the fire totem. Like, the fact that, like, obviously, he loves fire totem, he's gonna try that. And that's all I will say about that. Okay. The rest will go elsewhere.
Well, I agree with all of this, and I also really liked Sarah's arc and, you know, how the episode dealt with the darkness within her and her past, because we never really get to see much of what happened or any of her actions while she was still in the League of Assassins. We kind of met her after she had been with them for a few years, and that scene where she murders the man in his home was, like, super chilling to me and a stark contrast to the Sarah we know now. And I like that she seems comfortable enough now with Ava that she openly called her girlfriend. No offense to Nissa. I love you, Nissa. But I feel like this is the first time we've really seen her settle into a relationship like this one. And it makes sense that she'd be reluctant to push any further, but also frustrating, which will be my dislikes. I like the fact that we got to see many of the characters grapple with their inner demons and emotions. But I, like you guys said, I really loved Zari's scene with her, you know, her fake brother play out. And this is the first time we've seen him in, you know, physical form. And it was, like, really gut-wrenching to see how close they were and how she reacted to him. It was just very, you know, emotionally effective. And I also like that the death totem was actually used to progress the characters in some way, or at least show their vulnerabilities, which is what was missing last week with Elvis. This is the first time that Malus seemed to feel genuinely terrifying and powerful, and I like that Nora Dark also got to pop up to try to convince Sarah to join the evil club. And it was really sweet that Ava was the one to finally be able to, you know, pull Sarah out of the little realm. Constantine also made me laugh at several points, but the entire time all I was really thinking was that his accent is even more prominent here. Like, did I miss something? Or is that just me? But I also like that we got to see Gary again, and his parallel to the Dungeons and Dragons was a fun one. And I just like his never-ending optimism, right? Like, all this shit is going down, and he's just like, oh my god, I get to talk about my geeky side. So what did we not like in this episode?
Okay, so earlier in this week when the episode, like, actually premiered, and Tati and I were trying to explain what was going on with Wally on Legends to one of our friends, since she doesn't really watch Legends, but she was worried about what they were doing with Wally. And the best way that I could describe what the show was trying to do was that they were trying to paint him like an unloved orphan so that the Legends could save him and become his new family, or his real family, quote unquote. And then the next day on, like, Twitter, Ivy, who's at Miss Minute 42, kind of, like, echoed my sentiments exactly and added on to that by saying, like, even if the Flash show didn't love Wally, his family definitely did. And so for the Legends to try and recreate or rewrite this narrative that Wally wasn't loved by anyone is just really kind of offensive, and it's part of why I just feel bamboozled a little bit, because I thought, you know, at least getting on Legends that he would get an actual story, but if I knew the story was so bad, I'm like, no, take it back. Bring him back to the Flash now, you know? It's kind of disrespectful for them to throw all of his family out the window like that. The team I don't really give a fuck about, because I think there are some, like, legit issues with him not being fully incorporated into the team, because we never really got to see him, like, working with Cisco, for example, because they're both, like, mechanical engineers, so there could have been a lot mined from that dynamic. And then, like, you know, sometimes the Star Labs team feels as closed as some of the fandom would like it to be, when only just a certain amount of people can get into this club and no one else. So they could have definitely played that angle of it. So I don't really give a fuck that he about the team kind of thing, because I don't like the team sometimes. So that's fine. But, like, the whole comments about his father from last week with Elvis and then this week with Jesse, it just kind of, like, crossed the line for me, because he was saying that I don't come from a family like yours. Well, like, a family like hers, her dad is an overbearing, rageaholic helicopter parent. So it's not like she had the best relationship or family life with, and her mother died at some point. We don't know when, but her mother died. So she had a single parent and they didn't have a great relationship either. So it's not like she's any better than he was. So what exactly is this kind of family dynamic that made Wally feel like he supposedly wasn't, like, good enough compared to her family? His mother got clean, like, once she had him. So, and he had a good relationship with her. They had a very great relationship growing up. And he only turned to Illegal Racing to pay for her medical bills, because she was a single mother and they didn't have any money to pay for her treatment. So Legends chalking up Wally's past, like, a speed junkie with a drug addict for a mom. And then to have that to come from his white girlfriend, was kind of like, was pretty damn offensive to me. And then why did it have to be Jesse anyway? Like, Nate got his dead grandfather. Zari got her dead brother. The other Legends got people that were actually dead and family members important to their life. It would have been better, even if they wanted to do something about Wally not, you know, low-key not liking the situation with his mother and her drug past, then it would have been better coming from Francine and having him talk to her about it, instead of talking to his girlfriend about it. So they didn't, like, even if that was what they wanted to do with it, they didn't even do that right. I didn't really care about Nate getting choked up by his grandfather, to be honest, because I still have issues with Nate going on in the past two episodes now, so that was fine. But, like, the one thing really got to me, because I just thought that there should be no reason why Wally, one, has an issue with his mother that he couldn't have talked to her about, first of all, into why he would even think that. And he's met her father. He's met Harry. He knows what Harry's like. So compared to his relationship with Joe and Iris, it just doesn't really make sense for him to feel insignificant to Jesse because of that. And that's the entirety of my dislikes, mainly.
This is, like, all the Wally. Before I get into all the Wally, because it's just going to be like, remember what Jessica said just now? That is how I feel. I am tired of the Wave Rider already. I feel like it's giving me sort of Star Labs feels at the moment, that, like, we keep spending all our time on it. Like, people aren't allowed to leave. Like, if this had just been the only bottle episode, or, like, the first bottle episode, then you'd be like, oh, cool, this is different. But instead, we recently had a bottle episode with Zari, and the last couple times that we've been going out into the field, if you will, it's been sort of, like, confined to, like, inside locations for the most part. There was, like, the one cool scene with Nora and Ray with the German guards, but otherwise sort of, like, we're not getting the visits to other people as much in the last couple episodes as I've been expecting. So I'm feeling a little claustrophobic. I want to do a little bit more time period bouncing, please. And I'm not a fan of how the Sarah and Ava breakup went down. I, like, especially because I know Ava's not going anywhere, I would rather them have worked through that conversation on screen in this episode than have to have an episode that's going to bring them back together, which I hope next week does. But I feel like they could have just, Ava said, like, I don't care that you were a murderer, basically. I don't care about your past. I care about you now. And I feel like, you know, Sarah could be like, okay, thanks. But she's like, no, thank you. I'm emo right now. So yeah, I'm a little bit sad about that. I'm not, like, you know, it's not make or break for me. I saw a lot of people were really upset about saying, like, how could you do this? But don't worry. They're getting back together real soon. It's not, you know? That's almost why I'm like, why did you bother? So, yes. Though, actually, you know what? Before I get into the Wally stuff, I will point out something that a friend of mine was complaining about. And she's not a Legends fan. She can't get into it. And the reason why is because she can't get past, like, the plot holes. Right? Like, how can they not let Wally use his speed when his speed would solve all the problems? And, like, why would Mick even try to use the fire totem against Sarah and the death totem when, like, what are you going to do? Burn Sarah alive? Obviously, it's not going to work. Why would Nate bother trying to use the earth totem when he could just become the steel and hold her down until they've stopped her? So just, like, she had, like, many, many questions, and I was like, shit, I can't answer this because you're not supposed to think about these things when you're watching Legends.
That's true, because we haven't seen Nate be steely.
Like, budget issues. Like, we can't go outside and actually see what Memphis looks like because we don't have any money to buy exterior shots. And that's why we're on the Wave Rider. And that's why Nate can't steal up. He's having performance issues because we don't have...
But yeah, it does feel like something is, you know, something is off there. So yeah, that's that. On that. Well, actually, no, that's the thing. Like, I don't think they're going to change that because that is Legends at its core. It's full of plot holes, but you don't think about it because you enjoy it. But just for any of you out there who have that problem, you're not alone. Other people do feel that way. Anyway, yes, I can't stand the way that they're writing Wally's insecurities. Like, Wally himself being happy and bubbly and enjoying his speed, that's all great. I love that. But I can't, I don't know. I really hate that they're downplaying his intelligence, they're downplaying his connection to science, and it doesn't even feel like it's an arc leading him to rediscover his love of it and his, you know, so that he'll become the engineer of the ship, like Jax was. Instead, it just seems like they've really decided that he just wasn't in the same level as the others for God knows what reason. And they're also, you know, they're also downplaying his speed by having characters visibly annoyed or put out when he uses it, as if he doesn't have the most useful powers on the ship, which he does. And I was excited when, like, it showed him getting them out of there, like, when Demon Sarah first attacked, he pulled them out, and I was like, yes! But then he goes back in, and it was, like, immediately, like, all right. And they even had Zari be like, I tried to stop him, but he's gonna go do it and be stupid or whatever, and then, you know, it didn't work out. I was like, all right, I guess. But yeah, the Jesse scene, first off, why are they even showing Jesse? She's not dead. Everyone else got dead people. Yes, and then there's Jesse, who is alive, and only the relationship is dead. So, I don't know. That was weird. And I really hated that she referred to Francine as a drug addict because she is a reflection of what Wally thinks. And Wally never knew his mom as a drug addict. There's no reason for him to say that. He just knew her as a hardworking single mom who helped him and who always spent time with him and who, you know, whatever. Like, there was nothing wrong there until she got sick. And then he had to pay for her bills, but that's totally different. So I don't like that. And yeah, like, when I'm relieved that Iris wasn't mentioned in the episode, then you know that.
Yeah, like, thank God that you did not name drop Iris and that, you know, she does not exist for you. Thank you, Legends writers, for that, you know?
Right. So yeah. And then in a similar, it's kind of hypocritical because, like, while I hate the idea that Wally thinks he's not good enough for Jesse, because obviously he is, and in the show, in Flash, he was the one that was more, like, take it or leave it in terms of Jesse until the breakup, where she was super into him. I don't feel that way about the Nate and Amaya situation. Like, when the grandfather tells Nate, like, oh, Amaya doesn't deserve you. Or you don't deserve Amaya, sorry. And then I'm like, yeah, that's true. So, that's fine. I agree. But I did think it was weird that was the reason, like, that was the conversation he had with his grandfather, you know? Like, when he was like, oh, you'll never make me proud because something, then, like, you could have gotten into that, maybe. Like, you were supposed to be a history whatever buff and, you know, and now you're just wandering around not turning into steel, just annoying people on this ship. Like, then great. But instead it was like, you'll never make me proud. And also, your girlfriend is better than you. And I was like, okay, I guess. It was definitely a step down from the Zari and Sarah moments in the episode, basically. So there you go. Those are my... Oh, and then, I mean, this is not really a dislike because I don't really care that much. But it's been quite a while now that Mick has not been anything more than, like, sort of comedic relief, like, one-liner, angry face.
Yeah.
So he doesn't, like, I don't know, he's the one that feels the most stagnant right now, and I'm wondering what that means. Should they just give up on writing for him? I don't know.
For Legends, I feel like in terms of plot, they are not strong with that. So they have great singular episodes, but when it comes to actually focusing on plot or how it ties in together, they take way too long. Like, we're 3 episodes to the end, and it still feels like we're treading water, you know? I also continue to dislike the way Legends writes for Wally, and it's beginning to grate on my nerves to the point of, like, I screamed at my TV. I was really angry. I just continue to not understand why they're painting him as an insecure man who fled Team Flash because he wasn't smart enough or because Jesse broke his heart. Like, he thinks he wasn't good enough for Jesse? I don't believe that for 1 second. And neither did Wally before. And Wally being shown to be embarrassed by his family, I don't know when that happened. And thinking that Jesse comes from a good family and he doesn't? Her father is Harrison Wells. You know, and besides being super smart, it's not like she grew up in a more loving home than Wally did. More loving than how he claims Francine raised him or how much Joe and Iris love him, you know? So I dislike that whole scene because it played up on the fact that Wally was affected by his mom being a drug addict, which, like Tati said, he wasn't. It was out of left field because that's not the mom Wally grew up with at all. Francine was clean at that point, and I think it was a missed opportunity to not use Francine in the scene, knowing it would have been much more emotionally effective and moving in a way that would have been impactful than having Jesse be in the scene. Someone mentioned to me on Twitter that, oh, well, they used Francine last season to appear to Wally when Savitar was, like, roaming free. But she wasn't there for very long, and they never really mined that relationship at all.
Yeah, that is interesting, because in The Flash, they used her, Savitar used her to comfort Wally in that scene. So, that, like, even if, like I was saying, if the drug problem was something that he low-key had an issue with, you know, why couldn't he tell that to Francine on The Legend? So it would have been two different, like, Francine.
Exactly. And then for Jesse and Wally, it's like they were only in a relationship for so long, so it made no sense that would be what he's broken up about, to the point where she appears as an apparition to spew such hateful words to him, or even that the fact that he fled Team Flash because of their breakup. Like, you were together, what, a few months, long distance? Like, how many times did you actually see each other? I don't know. I'm just still so annoyed by this damn scene. And it also just continues to paint a picture that Wally had an issue with his family, which he did not. Anyway, all the team stuff aside, the Wests were never a problem, and I dislike that Legends is trying to undo all the character development, because that was the best stuff that Wally did get on The Flash. Anyway, in other non-Wally-related dislikes, I also didn't like that they actually used the broody "I have to break up with you to protect you" bit for Sarah. I know they'll get them back together, but I've always hated that reasoning behind a breakup, and I know it's popular on superhero shows, but I really wish that they would stop using it. Like, Ava is already in the middle of all the danger anyway. What is breaking up with her going to do? I don't know. Moving on to predictions. Do we have any?
Not really. It's not like a prediction, but I'm just, like, wondering, like, what happened for all the totems to be split up in the first place, and the only one that stayed in Zambezi was Amaya's? Like, what happened to the other lost Zambezi tribes? If the Arab totem was, like, an heirloom from Zari's brother, does that make her, like, part Zambezi? Or, like, I don't know how this is supposed to work. If the fire totem resonates with Mick, is he Zambezi? Like, is Elvis Zambezi? I don't get it. Like, I don't know. We don't even know who created the totems. Did the Zambezi tribes create the totems? And, I'm thinking too hard, but it's just, like, how does this spiritual, mystical totem thing work that just anybody can just pick up a totem off the street and be a totem bearer?
The writers don't care, okay?
I just have questions. I have no answers.
So, here's my prediction. Given that Nora was trying to pull Sarah to the dark side, like you, lady, already punt, I am wondering if one of the good guys is going to go bad. Because if that's what he needs to do, then one of the Totem Bearers probably will get pulled in, like the episode before. Kind of like Doomworld, right? Where Mick and Snart, you know, Mick was on the Snart side for, like, a hot second. Now, I was going to say, it's going to be Mick again, but then I just realized it happened to Mick already, so maybe not Mick. Maybe someone else. But yeah, that's my prediction. Someone's going to go bad with the totem a little bit more permanently than Sarah, and actually work with Dark. There you go.
Yes, that's better than what I have. This is not really a prediction, but I am impatient because I'm wondering what happened to Kuasa and why they seem to be holding off on Amaya's story overall. If all those Zambezi totems gather everyone, why are they not focusing on her since she is Zambezi? And a lame prediction, but I do think that Nate's fake grandpa telling him that he doesn't deserve Amaya still means he'll either die or that he'll be revealed to be the baby daddy and then die. I don't know.
Either way, he dies.
All right, moving on to Black Lightning. Jefferson is still hell-bent on going after the ASA and contacts Henderson at the police station. Henderson agrees to investigate the shady dealings of some of the corrupt cops, so long as Black Lightning promises to tell his family that he was one of the good guys should he die. Jefferson promises that isn't going to happen. Another promise Jefferson makes is to Lynn about protecting her and their children, to which Lynn asks if he can even make that promise to begin with, and laying down his life isn't any better for Lynn. I don't know how this woman sleeps at night. Henderson investigates, and so does Jefferson and Anissa, and they discover the company who tried to pay off Jefferson's dad. Henderson also discovers that the police chief is dealing with Martin Proctor in exchange for weapons, and also that they have a building set up to make more green light. Anissa, who learned how to lip read so she'd know what the cops are saying during protests, learns that Proctor intends to relocate the building, and so it's her and Jefferson's last chance to destroy the place. Before heading there, Anissa goes to see Gamby, and she wonders why he and her dad aren't speaking, and he tells her the bare minimum and presents her with the new suits, telling her to please protect herself. Anissa tries to appeal to her dad that Gamby knows he was wrong, but that he ultimately cares, but Jefferson isn't ready to speak to him. Anissa pulls on her new suit, and the father-daughter duo take down Proctor for now and blow up the building filled with new green light. Mission accomplished. Meanwhile, Jennifer discovers that not only does Anissa have powers, but that her dad is also Black Lightning. Jennifer is understandably mad at her family for lying to her, but she gets to have some great moments with each of them. Later, Lynn explains that she and Jefferson never lied, but they omitted the truth to keep her and Anissa safe, and that by the time Jennifer was old enough to understand, Jefferson had stopped being Black Lightning. Jennifer was scared because she didn't ask for this and wonders if she'll be able to have kids, and also expresses her want for a normal life. She says that she's not Anissa. Lynn lets her be angry and cry. Later, Jennifer tells Jefferson that she understands the reasoning behind covering up the truth, while Jefferson apologizes, and they watch a movie together like old times, and that's what you miss on Black Lightning, because there was more family stuff than there was plot, which is okay, because it was all great. Ladies, what are we like?
I was about to say, like, whoa, you went right through that.
I really recapped it in a flash.
Well, I've been nagging the writers in my mind and in my reviews, like, where is Jennifer's story? And then we finally got it this episode. So, like, all of the Jennifer point of view, I love that we got to spend so much time on her feelings and that she got important scenes with each member of her family about her powers and the situation of them lying to her. I was so afraid, actually, after she walked off when the first confrontation, when she finds out that her dad is Black Lightning and her sister has powers. And she, like, walks off, like, how could you lie to me? I thought, well, that's the end of that. We're not going to see her the rest of the episode. Because, the next scene was just Anissa, Lynn, and Jefferson talking about, well, back to Green Lightning, or Green Lightning. But we actually did get to see, like, her talk to her family in multiple scenes. I like that Lynn gave her space, but not too much space, so that when it became clear that Jennifer was just going to ice him out for a while, she came in and was like, look, you know, we did have reasons. And I actually kind of agree. Like, I thought that Anissa would think, out of all the people in the family, that Anissa would be the one that says, like, she needed to know. But I also agreed with Lynn that that was not the way that Jennifer needed to know. Like, this needed to be, like, a sit-down family discussion, not, like, Anissa, like, throwing up the bed and being like, that's what they... Dad's lying to you too. So I thought that, you know, Lynn was good for her to, I did try to give you space, but I don't want you to be mad because you need to understand that as parents, this is what our reasoning was. Like, first you were too little and, you know, couldn't risk you blurting it out. And then as you got older, he'd already stopped being Black Lightning, so it didn't matter anymore. So I liked getting her reasoning for it and that Jennifer needed to hear it, but I also liked Jennifer confiding her fears about not having a normal life and marriage and kids and all that kind of stuff. And I like that she's so different from Anissa, because these are two sisters, but they're completely opposites. Like, Anissa is, and I kind of understand Anissa's Harriet Tubman nickname a little bit more now, because Anissa is, like, the one that wants to, like, go out and rescue everybody in Freeland and be proactive, and Jennifer is not like that, and it's the one time that she tried to be like that, Khalil got his spine severed and turned into a dick. So, like, I can understand why she would be, like, apprehensive about having powers. Does not necessarily mean that your life is going to be better, kind of thing. I liked that I do like that she was also looking through videos about Black Lightning and Thunder, because it shows that she's not completely opposed to it. She does kind of have that interest, and I thought it was cute that Anissa was, like, a little bit smug that she had more fans than her dad did. And that Paige, which I totally have a prediction about, and if it's not that, then I'm not going to say that, because it is what I think it is. I was shocked when Jen name-dropped Vixen in the episode, and then Lynn name-dropped Supergirl, so I was like, that's cool. I don't really want them to cross over, but it's kind of cool that they name-dropped two like, powerful women in the DC family, superhero family. They caught up to Proctor quicker than I was expecting. Like, Jennifer and Jefferson made a really good duo this team, and, you know, they got, like, the classic walk away from a building while it explodes behind you kind of thing going on, so that was cool. And I'm glad that Gambi wasn't immediately forgiven in this episode, but it seemed like he was, more so than other episodes, he was doing something because he wanted to atone for himself, and not because he was trying to get on Jefferson's good side. So I thought that that was really a good shift for his character development. And I thought that Anissa made a kind of a good comparison, I think, on how is Gambi withholding information to protect Jefferson that much different from you lying to us our entire lives about you being Black Lightning. So I thought that was kind of it puts it in a place for Gambi to be redeemed later.
Those are all very good links. I definitely loved seeing Jennifer's point of view. And like you said, like, we've been waiting for her to get her story. And I had at first been like, well, why didn't they do it together? They both have powers together, and then we can see, like, sister team up. The only reason to not do that is if they're going to have a very different story for Jennifer once she gets her powers. So I'm glad that that is the case. It doesn't just feel like a repeat of the Anissa situation. It really is showcasing just how different both sisters are. And also how different it is to go through learning about these powers and keeping them to yourself, like Anissa did, versus learning about them and immediately going to your family and then having to deal with it in a different way, like Jennifer. Ooh. So I think it's going to be very interesting to see how that pushes Jennifer forward and in what path she takes to eventually use her powers or not. And I also like that she was given the space to be okay, or to not be okay with having these powers, and to not want to use those powers to be a superhero at this moment. Like, they did it in a way that made it feel very realistic and understandable, you know, because, like, your first instinct is to say, like, oh, well, that's just selfish then. And a lot of superhero media is like that. It's either black or white, right? Like, you either use your powers to be a hero, or use them to be a villain, the end. So it's nice to sort of explore the in-between and to do it in such an effective way. Like, Jennifer is still a full character, and she's still, like, a good person, even if she doesn't want to use her powers to be a hero. I also like how it sort of sets up the I don't know, like, Anissa is so much like her father, and that's why they're getting along so well with the training together, but also clashing, because it's like, she does things just like he does, and he doesn't like that. And at the same time, Jennifer is more like Lynn. And Lynn still helps people in her own way. Like, Lynn's still a doctor, so it's not like, just because she doesn't love the power, you know, she doesn't love her family going out there and getting themselves killed, doesn't mean that she's not going out and trying to make the world better. And that's why I especially loved her scenes with Lynn, and I thought that they were really powerful. I teared up when Jennifer was crying about, you know, the thought of no one loving her, and then not even being able to have kids, maybe. You know, she doesn't know about that. And it was like a really sweet moment for their relationship, which has been a little bit neglected in favor of Lynn and Anissa. And so now we get to really see how Lynn is with Jennifer. But it's also, like, it's not just that Jennifer never asked for the powers and she didn't have time to prepare for them. So it's, you know, it's coming as a huge shock to her. And so it's even worse than just learning about them, or, like, being told about them earlier and then having time to prepare. But Lynn, like, all these fears she's had about her, about the powers and about how they affect Jefferson and protecting her children from Jefferson's lifestyle, she never thought about what it would mean for them to actually have powers. And so now that her daughter is worried that no one's going to love her, and she has her mother and father breaking up over powers as proof of that, it's just not something that Lynn prepared for or even considered. So even though she was spending all her life protecting the people she loves by omission, she can't protect Jennifer from what happens when she finds out on her own and, like, how it's going to affect her. So that was really, I thought, really powerful, and they wrote it really well. I also continue enjoying the Jefferson and Anissa team up. I think it's great. I love they're making good progress. Like you said, that whole building exploding and then walking behind it. I love that Anissa got her own theme song. She's got her
magic theme song. That was cool.
Yes, I loved it. And I love her new costume. Thank you, Gambi. He's good for something.
He's got great taste.
Yeah. I also like that, like, you know, like you said, Gambi's on his own path of redemption, but also Anissa, I think she even said, like, I'm not going to just take your word on Gambi for it. You know, like, I'm going to decide on my own how I feel about Gambi. So, you know, you can just, and, you know, watch me put on this suit. And he's obviously not trying to hurt us. So that is interesting that, like, they didn't go a route of them thinking that Gambi is trying to hurt them. It was just like, you lied and that's what's bad. So, yeah, that's all.
Yeah, because I remember I'm, like, the Gambi shady conspiracy theorist. But all great likes, ladies. This episode, for me personally, just made me cry. I cried, like, 3 times. Well, not, like, cried, but, you know. Tears, a couple of tears ran down my face. The single man tear. I love the fact that Jennifer got to be angry at her family and that she, you know, she shared emotional and impactful scenes with each one of them. Like just said, I thought that she was also going to be ignored. I was like, oh, I guess she's going to be mad for an episode off screen. But I'm glad that that didn't happen. And I like that in her scene with Anissa, they felt like true sisters in which they got to talk about everything that's happened and the gravity of it, but also that Jennifer went snooping online like Anissa did before, but instead happened, you know, she came across fan pages, which was hilarious that Anissa was the more popular between her and Black Lightning. And I felt like that was really meta because I feel like online Anissa is more popular than Black Lightning.
Yeah, I definitely felt like they were calling the fandom out.
Yeah.
Like, oh.
But I think the scene that touched me the most was Jennifer's scene with Lynn. And I like that Lynn allowed, you know, she allowed her to be angry, but also explained why they kept the secret from her, which made sense up until recently. And I love that Jennifer provided a different perspective from, like, the whole I gained superpowers, so where's my super suit mentality, you know? She just wants to be normal and didn't ask for her powers, which is understandable that she doesn't immediately want to rush out to be a superhero. And I like especially that this scene showcased the differences between her and Anissa and how Jennifer is more like Lynn, thinking about how this new revelation impacts her life, you know, her current life, her future life. Like, it's not a topic that's often discussed on superhero shows, right? It's like, assume that that's what someone with newly acquired powers will do, which is suit up and go out and help the city. So I really enjoyed Jennifer's perspective. And, you know, it broke my heart when she asked whether or not she'd be able to have kids. And then Lynn's speechlessness was really emotional and so well acted by Chynna Ann McClain and Christine Adams. Lynn's protectiveness as a parent is getting harder and harder for her, and I really feel her pain, given that she's tried so hard over the years, but still can't protect her kids from everything, so that was really sad. I really enjoyed Anissa and Jefferson's continued team-up, and how Anissa got to remember something from her grandfather's research that ultimately led them to the warehouse. And Anissa strutting out with her new suit, that was a really great scene. The little, you know, the details on the suit are really great. I feel like they parallel, you know, Anissa's personality. And I also immensely enjoyed the shot of Anissa and Jefferson walking away, badasses, as the building explodes behind them. And I also like that Gambi was given enough time to voice his side to Anissa and also show his continued concern for the Pierce family without eating up too much screen time like last episode. And I really believe that he cares for them, even though he's been shady since day one, but he does care. I will admit he's just a lying liar who lies, but that's okay because he can be redeemed. So what do we not like?
I actually like this episode a lot more than last week. So I don't have a lot of dislikes. The main thing that I don't like is that this is the second episode that we have not seen Tobias at all. And I think that is unusual and it's weird. Like, Tori just died. So where is he? What is he doing? How is he plotting his revenge against Jefferson and Black Lightning? You know, why is Jefferson not more concerned about where he is or what he's doing? We know Martin Proctor is a person that exists and that he's connected to the ASA, but we still don't really have a handle on what the ASA is doing and why. And so, like, the big bad for me, like, at first it was Tobias, and then I'm like, well, maybe it's Lady Eve. And now we got Martin Proctor. I'm like, there's too many people. And then Lala's thrown in there somewhere. So I just don't really know who the fuck that I'm supposed to be looking towards. Like, how does this all... It seems like the show is spreading itself a little bit too thin on big bads. Like, we don't need all of them in one season. We could, like, spread it out a little bit more. So it's kind of difficult to tell where... Is the season headed towards a showdown with Tobias or with ASA? I can't possibly take down ASA in this episode, in this season, because what are they going to do for the rest of the seasons? I don't know. And, like, it just makes even less sense why Lala was in last week, and we don't see him this week. So, and we didn't get any information or clues about how he got resurrected last week. So it just doesn't really make sense why he was included at all, and not, like, more, and, like, another scene of Martin Proctor to kind of tell more about who he is and, like, what he's actually doing. Is he, how is he connected to Lady Eve and to, like, the whole thing? So, there's a little bit of confusion to how all of the villains kind of fit together.
I agree about that confusion, for sure. And, like you, I didn't have very many dislikes at all, because I thought it was a really strong episode. Like, my favorite parts of Black Lightning are when they center on the family and those different dynamics, so I'm really happy with that, which is probably why the extra ties are, like, you know, my less favorite thing. Like you, yeah, of course, Tobias not being in here two episodes in a row after his sister died sort of is confusing as a question mark, and it diminishes what a large, complicated role he played in the story early on. So it is a little bit weird, and also, I don't know why we had the Lala scenes last week if they weren't following it up, you know, this week. Because it's like, and just knowing that he had come back from the dead would have been enough. Like, he didn't really do anything last week that could have used Tobias there instead, basically, is what I'm saying. So, this is preemptive. So, it's not really a dislike. Because, again, there wasn't really much to dislike. But I really hope there are not reproductive issues for Jennifer. Like, the fact that she brought it up took me out for a moment. Because I was like, why would there be? Like, obviously, ovaries, wombs are different from sperm. So, like, yeah, Jefferson and kids doesn't mean that Jennifer can. But I would hope they don't, because I feel like that is something, like, oftentimes women are punished for powers in a way that men are not in comics and whatever. So I hope they don't go there, basically. That's all I'm saying. I hope that doesn't happen. It probably won't, because the Keels are the best. So there you go. That's all.
I think my biggest frustration is that, because the episode was really good, like you guys were saying, but I feel like they got rid of the green light stuff too quickly. But I agree with Jess. Like, I don't know what happens to Tobias either. And especially given that his sister just died, to have him not appear again is, like, stalling in a way where it's like, okay, well, the tension is kind of disappearing now with what's going on with him because he's not in the episode. So, like, it throws off the momentum. And now it just feels like there are two separate stories, even though we know they're connected. But I want to know. But it's like something has shifted and the stories disconnect will only grow wider if they don't get back to Tobias and the LaWanda storyline. So gotta keep that up. I don't know how I feel about Martin Proctor. I know he's just, like, evil, but I don't know if I completely buy that storyline yet. Because he's only been around the last two episodes and only for a short amount of time. And I totally agree with Tati about reproductive issues. It's not something I thought about immediately because I was just sad about the scene. But now that she brought it up, I was like, oh, you're right. Like, Jefferson obviously didn't have one, so, like, it shouldn't be a concern. He obviously had two lovely daughters, so I don't see why it should be an issue. But I just want them to get back to LaWanda and Tobias. Like, what's going on? Tell us. But other than that, the episode was really good. Predictions.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Grace totally started that on her fan page. Because she did. About how she's, like, challenging patriarchy's role of heroes. And this also, like, brings up another question, like, where the fuck is Grace? Because if we weren't going to get Thunder Grace immediately, I don't even see what the point of breaking up Anissa and Chinua after one episode was supposed to be. Mm-hmm. If they break Anissa and Chinua up, and then immediately, like, in that same episode, like, Anissa's fighting with Grace, and then we don't see Grace for another, like, eight episodes. So, like, what was the point of that if you weren't even going to, like, bring Grace in and, like, include her in the plot with Anissa, like, discovering her powers? What was the point? Like, Jennifer still remembers Chinua and brought her up. So, obviously, the girl had some kind of impact on the family and was around long enough for them to get to know her. So, like, why couldn't we get to know her? Why, you know? And then get to know Grace slowly later if you weren't going to plan on doing Thunder Grace anyway. So, that's my prediction slash dislike complaint.
The fact that Jennifer brought up, that's why Anissa and Chenoa broke up, because her powers. I was like, no, it ain't. That's not true. Who told you that? So, and I guess no one knows why Anissa and Chenoa broke up, but it was another moment that I was like, wait a second, that's not true. That's not even remotely true. It was because of Grace, who is not here anymore.
Probably my biggest disappointment of the season is that, like, they're like, oh, we have this lesbian superhero. But I'm like, but you're not building it up. Like, I don't know where she's gone, and I want her back.
So, hopefully she'll get to build her love story back up in the last few episodes. And, like, there's no way it's not getting a season 2. So, like, we're definitely going to get to see it more.
Yeah.
But it is a little, like, again, you know, we had 2 free spaces last week taken up by Lala doing nothing. So, I'm going to be Tobias, and one of them could be Grace. But, oh, well. Yeah. As for predictions, I don't have one. I'm trying to come up with one now. But I do think that green light being gone right now is because Tobias was gone right now. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like they're not going to move the green light storyline forward without Tobias. So that makes me think that maybe Crondon was doing something, like a tour or, like, you know, whatever, something musical. He's a musician, right? I didn't just make that up.
Yeah.
Okay. So, so maybe, like, they couldn't use him for those episodes, and that's why. But I definitely think that when he pops up again, the green light will come back, because they did explain that, like, this was a drug that was literally used to sedate people or whatever, you know, like, it was used to bring, to, like, calm people, control them. So I feel like maybe there'll be some other version that they're, like, they've updated or something, because, like, they had Lindsay Smith, like, oh, they've been working on it for 30 years, right? So that makes me feel like that wouldn't necessarily be true, unless there is going to be, like, a new and improved version that they're going to put out.
I think my only prediction is that, or this is more of a want, but hey, people are popping up like daisies, right? Like, Lady Eve can just resurrect. I don't know what it has to do with LaWanda, but it could happen. I'm just saying.
Or when Tobias finds out that you can resurrect people, maybe he'll resurrect Tori.
Yes.
I'd be down with both of those things, because Lady Eve will come back like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, shit. So, like, get, like, Lady Eve versus,
I already,
Tobias.
Love all the scenarios going on in my head.
That would never play out.
Of course, Will can still come back.
But we always have fan fiction. Oh, by the way, like, the guy that plays Will has been, I don't know if he's just hinting because he likes the attention of having been on Black Lightning, but he was telling us that we should watch next week. So he was kind of, like, winking that he might make an appearance. So, even more randomness that we will not get answers to if Will comes back next week.
Moving into our side A and only side for Lady with Gumption nominations and winner. Who is your nominee? Why? Go.
I'm going to go with Ava. Yeah, she was the knight in shining armor for her, you know, previous assassin lover. Like, she found out something was wrong with Sarah and, you know, went into problem solver mode, you know, talked to the legends. She even worked with John, even though he discussed her, because that was how she was going to get her girlfriend back. You know, she brought her back. So, you know, from the demon realm. So, power for Ava.
And all she got for it was this lousy breakup.
Right, all she got for it was, you know, and I think she deserves it, because she did a lot of work, and, like, Sarah dumped her, so.
Bad Sarah.
But I do think that she, you know, this was the most kind of proactive that we've seen about her, and it was about her trying to rescue Sarah. So I thought she showed a lot of gumption and quick thinking on her part.
Yeah, I like that a lot, because, like, I was just sitting here thinking, I'm like, well, Sarah had to deal with a lot, but it was mostly possessed, right? And it was Ava who pulled her out, who gave strength to come out. So yeah, you're at that. And then on the other hand, Jennifer's was all emotional work. Like, it was a great episode for her, but there was not an action involved. She was, you know, just processing what she's learned. Exactly. So yeah, I really think, I think you might be right on the Ava. Do you got another one, May?
I was just going to give a shout out to Anissa, but Ava was my pick as well. So she's my first pick for all the reasons Jess mentioned. And just a shout out to Anissa, though, just because she, you know, she remembered that little research she did for about her grandfather and really owned her new suit and just walked into her first major mission like a badass, so.
Yeah, you go, Anissa. But equal in.
Yes, so Ava is our Lady with Gumption of the Week for episode 28.
A long way with our opinions and Ava. Like, our relationship has evolved.
I know, right?
Has evolved.
Yeah.
You go, Ava. You've proven that we can be swayed.
That's true.
All right. We will take a short break, and we will be back with side B / sort of C. Fan and shipping, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
And welcome back. We are here with side B / C. The good, the bad, and the ugly. I am your new introductor, is Jessica. And before we start, I have a PSA announcement. Watch On the Block. If you want, like, a Netflix recommendation right now, and it is, Netflix is kind of notoriously, for some reason, you know why, .gif, for underpromoting its, like, diversity-led shows, and I would have never have even known about One Day at a Time unless Tati had told me in May that we needed to watch it because it was in danger of not being renewed for season 3. So, and I had known about On the Block from like a news report like months before it debuted. But then I was on Twitter and then Gabrielle Union was like, you need to watch On the Block, or On My Block. And I was like, oh yeah, what's out? So I shouldn't have to need Gabrielle Union tweeting me to remind me to watch a new show. But it is an entirely Black and Latinx cast, young actors. On My Block is funny. It's an emotional kind of coming-of-age story of four friends who are trying to keep their friend group together as they enter high school. You've got Jamal, who's kind of like the comic relief, high anxiety, OCD, can't keep other people's secrets. Really funny, really great character. Kind of like the adventure of the group. You've got Ruby, who is an eloquent romantic, smart, very persuasive, the problem solver, the fixer. And like the Jamal-Ruby combo is just like amazingly funny. You've got Monse, who is the only girl, but she's like the feminist, super stubborn, but kind of really fiercely protective of her friends and her family, because they are like her family for the most part. And then you've also got Caesar, who's like the charismatic dreamer who's got all these plans, but he gets caught up in the family business of like gangbanging in the neighborhood. And so it's up to his friends to find a way to save him. It's only 10 episodes or half hour episodes. You can knock it out in a lazy afternoon. It's a really good show, and I just think that more of these kinds of shows, One Day at a Time, On My Block, need more promotion that they're not getting from traditional sources. So it's up to us to demand Netflix give us diversity shows and like renew these seasons so we can have those kind of like storylines represented. And then kind of on that subject, we've been thinking about this for a couple of weeks, but we just haven't had space to put it into the podcast. But right before the Oscars, there was an article that came out about racism in Hollywood, and specifically this acting coach named Leslie Kahn. There's a leaked tape of her giving advice to a young white Jewish student on how to get more castings, and her advice was to, she suggested that the girl rebrand herself as a Rosa Ramirez and do something like outrageous, like wear a lot of red and a lot of like sparkly earrings, because that, you know, signals that Latina or whatever, and change her name to the most Latin name she could think of. And she's telling this as a white woman, telling another white Jewish student that if you want to get gigs in Hollywood, then you need to become a Latina and take those roles. And she was like, stop admitting to being a huge Jew, okay? Because apparently, if you want representation, you should steal somebody else's. And then, of course, the tape was leaked, so she got caught. And so she sent out a bullshit apology about, I believe in diversity and inclusion in the arts in all areas of life. As a Jewish woman, I understand the pain that can come from being discriminated against. So, not really. But, like, what did you guys think about when you heard about that article?
First, I totally second your watch On the Block, On My Block, guys, do it. But I mean, I wasn't shocked. Like, I was more shocked that it came out, because like obviously you know that kind of thing happens. But I guess I would have imagined it happens in like subtler ways. Like to have someone so blatantly coach you to just be a huge stereotype in order to get more roles. It does really speak to that idea, like people really think that they're being replaced or whatever, or even because, yeah, you can be pigeonholed or discriminated against in terms of like what kind of roles you get as a Jewish woman, but like to trade one stereotype for another or one form of discrimination for another doesn't seem like it's any better. So
what made me laugh was that she makes it sound like there's so many roles and that lady just wasn't getting it. Like be a stereotypical Latina and, you know, you get so many jobs. I'm like, on what planet? Like, this is still Hollywood. Jobs, there like, are no roles.
The help or, like, the gang member's girlfriend.
Right. And it's just, fine. I mean, like Tatya, I wasn't surprised because this stuff happens all the time. But it is just frustrating to me because it's like we talked about with Maggie's casting and Floriana Lima and how people who aren't...
coach.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and how people who are not, you know, if it's a casting call for a certain ethnicity, people who are not that ethnicity are still going into those auditions and pretending to be that ethnicity. And I don't think that that's cool at all, you know, because it's like, I know Hollywood is super competitive, but then to try to be something you're not and take those roles and take the authenticity away is just disgraceful.
Yeah, and kind of leading into that, also around that time, you got Amanda Stenberg that she was claiming that she chose to drop out of the running for Shuri in Black Panther, and, you know, a lot of people called her out, like, was it really yours to give away in the first place? Like, probably not. And then, like, Alexandra Shipp, you know, our favorite. She kind of followed up on that, like, in defense of Amanda and some of her recent comments on colorism, which honestly, I didn't read whatever article because I just didn't want to, like, listen to the bullshit. But it's more kind of, like, the same. I think she tried to make, like, a Crayola marker analogy about, you know, whatever type of brown that they used in the comics didn't matter or something like that. But yeah, it's for me, it's just kind of like the same thing. Like, you were being purposely obtuse about the issue and why it is an issue. And it's kind of along the same lines as, you know, going to auditions that are meant for darker skinned women, but because you are more conventionally attractive by Hollywood standards, you know that you can go in and you can take that role away from someone else that is darker skin and kind of cut that opportunity to for people to see darker skin women as more attractive, as more full-bodied three-dimensional characters that can carry that role. So it's kind of like hoarding all of there's not that many to begin with, but then you've got other people coming in hoarding all of this, the small hoard of treasure of those roles, and no one kind of is able to break through that. So
yeah. I think for Alexander, because I did read most of Alexandra Shipp's interview, and she was saying something along the lines of, well, she wouldn't give up the role because even if they didn't hire her, they'd hire another lighter skin actress as well.
So she's protecting but I some kind of like weird like backwards.
Yeah, like at least if someone's gonna be benefiting, it should be me.
yeah, basically.
I don't know. I feel like she's already put her foot in her mouth so many times that obviously she's just not learning the lesson. It's going right over her head. I do hope that this is why, like, we need to have people at the top of the food chain, if you will, change their minds. Like, that's the mind that we need to change. Like,
exactly.
Because it's true that even just, like, one actress advocating, like, for example, Amanda Stenberg, like, maybe her heart is in the right place. I don't know. Or just maybe she just wanted attention. But either way, like, she is saying, like, Yeah. But, like, at least she is speaking out about the idea of stepping down and doing that. But, like, even... Because, in a way, Alexandra's not wrong. Just because she steps down doesn't mean someone else won't. Right. Which is why you have to change the minds of the people at the top. You have to get darker-skinned actresses in the room to begin with to be able to get that role. It's like, I always go back to this. When you see how, you know, Smallville, Chloe was going to be black, and then Allison Mack walked in.
Yeah.
And they're like, yes, you should be Chloe,
you walk in on a black woman's audition, and now we must have you.
And they shouldn't let that even happen.
Mm-hmm.
She shouldn't be able to walk in that room. It should just be like, no, sorry, this is for black women. And hopefully that's more often the case now, but we still see things where the wrong kind of race bending happens, just whitewashing happens. So,
right, because besides race bending from white to what, you know, something else, is also a problem of, like, the interchangeable person of color, right? Like, well, you look close enough, so it's fine.
Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, so that's the kind of, like, the people who believe strongly in this and who know what the industry really needs have to be able to be put in those positions or change mm-hmm. the hearts and minds of the people who are in those positions. And like, and while I think that like Cloak and Dagger, you know, they just showed their pilot, which I didn't get to see, but at WonderCon, and they just did the press room for it. And I thought it was interesting. Like, obviously it's based on like a white woman and a black man, you know, it's a race is a very integral part. But when I asked the question about behind the scenes, like how much diversity did you incorporate behind the scenes to have an authentic voice? Because like Gina Blythe, I can't remember her full name, Love and Basketball, Beyond the Lights.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. Director. She directed the pilot. So like I was like, so like Gina, is there more behind the scenes work that's being done to make sure that the voices are authentic? And the showrunner, I know the showrunner is a white man for sure. And Jeff Loeb's response was basically like, oh, well, I just hope that we reach the post-racial age of when that doesn't matter. It's just about talent. And I was like, but the talent.
That means no.
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, okay, so the answer is no. But the talent, you know, you think that the white man that you hired is the most talented because that's what you've been conditioned to believe. And you don't even get the chance to see the other people because of what, you know, what's happened so far. Like, how we've been conditioned, what circumstances we've had, etc. So that's why we gotta get rid of the white men. No, I'm just kidding, but
we have just like showrunners, but like you said, for authentic voices, you know, having more diverse writers' rooms. So if you're gonna have like a more diverse cast, it makes sense to diversify your writers' rooms so that they can write better for those characters because they're going to understand that experience. And it's not like there isn't talent, they just don't want to look for it because they like the status quo.
It's easy that way.
Right.
But anyway, we have to move along to the main course of this side, which is about fan and shipping. It was requested by @WestAlamoLore on Twitter. We're going to talk about the good, the bad, and the ugly side of shipping non-canon pairs, also known as fan and shipping, or it's not so attractive cousin crack shipping. So we'll talk about when he goes from like fun fan and shipping to crack shipping as well. And how those pairings reflects the audience's views on relationships and hierarchy in the real world. So we'll take it back to our host, May, who's going to get us started.
All right. So we're going to start with the good. When fan and shipping can be fun, like example, slash shipping for LGBT fans that never really get to see themselves represented because most characters are default straight, unfortunately, but then the other side is exploring new dynamics between different characters. So like two characters that maybe that one character showed up on screen for 2 seconds and you thought it would be really cool if the other characters interacted with them in a different type of capacity. That type of shipping. What do we think about the good side for fan and shipping?
Well, I think that, you know, because when you talk about like non-canon pairs, a lot of times with fandom ship wars, it kind of devolves into something negative, but it doesn't always have to be negative because, like, you know, like we said, like the good, you can get just new dynamics between characters because the plot may go one way, but you see these two characters seem to get along, and if only they had more time together, what could they become? And so then you get into like, that's what fan fiction is for. As far as like new dynamics, I really like Super Flash, which is Barry and Kara. And I don't ship them romantically because I don't really happen to multi-ship Barry romantically at all. But I just enjoy like their dynamic a lot. And I know that Barry plus white woman gets on many people's nerves for like obvious reasons because they do, and the media certainly definitely tried to go there when he first crossed over to Supergirl and that was announced and they tried to make it a thing. Like they tried to make every Barry white woman guest star like a thing, even if he's a guest star. But you know, I like that Melissa didn't play into it at all. And then on screen, it was obvious that Barry and Kara were just like really good friend, happy kind of people. And if we're going to say like on TV that you should have more male-female dynamics that are platonic and are friendly, like this is the kind of ship that BROTP that I would like to see. And so it doesn't really bother me when they get scenes together because they're very cute together. They have a nice, friendly chemistry, and I think that's cool, and it's fine. And it's you know, I think the actors or the actresses have a lot to do with that as well, knowing their characters and knowing how to play their characters, and it's just in good fun. For example, with Iris, I like Cold West, because, which is Leonard Snart, Captain Cold, and Iris West, because it is a thing in mechanics in the comics. There is some kind of background there that, unfortunately, they never explored on the show. So for me, Cold West is kind of a way to explore through fiction what could have been on the show if the writers had actually chosen to go there. And the same thing with Tony and Iris, Girder, which I'm probably the only person on this little boat, but I just, this, again, like, I think it was another kind of missed opportunity for kind of a frenemy kind of thing with Barry and Tony, and then kind of like a Tony only begrudgingly helping them because of his feelings for Iris, and like exploring, there's like a lot of dynamics that weren't explored. So for me, like, fan fiction is a way to kind of explore that side of the what if kind of thing.
Someone
read for a Tony Iris fic. Please, be a Tony Iris fic, somebody. I would read it and give you all the praise in the world. Or people that like Sarah, want Sarah and Iris to have scenes together based off of Katie and Candace's chemistry and the friendship. So you got like all these, you know, people in real life that are really good, have a lot of great chemistry together, but they don't get that on screen. So fan shipping is a good way to kind of express those kind of interests. And then with respect to Flash shipping, to be honest, like, out of all the characters on Supergirl that could have been announced as LGBTQ in season 2 when they had that big kind of mystery announcement, I thought that Kara made the most sense to be at least like pansexual, because as an alien, I feel like, you know, she wouldn't be that caught up on traditional sexual orientations and all that. It just made sense for me that she would just not be straight. But they made Alex a lesbian, and they gave her like a beautiful story. So there wasn't anything that was missing, I think, from her story, because we did get a lovely story out of it. But I just didn't think that once they made Alex a lesbian, that they would also make Kara LGBT. So because she's not going that route on the show, then you get, again, fan and shipping. So for example, Supercore became so popular because she and Lena, Katie McGrath, have really great chemistry on screen. They have a good dynamic. There is story there in the narrative that you could pull into a good relationship history for Kara and Lena. There's a story there. And it was just like a bright spot and a positive alternative in a season where the narrative was like pushing Mon-El and pushing Mon-El and pushing Mon-El, who was not like the, it wasn't the best story. So Supercore had a better story. And then outside of DC TV, you've got Storm Pilot, which is from the Star Wars fandom. It's Finn and
Poe.
Finn and Poe Dameron, which is really super rare.
I forgot my darling Poe's name.
Yeah. I'm sorry. But it's super rare because it's like two men of color. So that's, you know, another thing that you don't really see. And like that fandom, from what I can tell, doesn't really seem to downplay or exclude Rey at any point. If anything, they like to include her in an OT3. So you just get like a lot of fun from that all around. And then also Eleanor and Tahani on The Good Place also seems like a slash ship, that there's a lot of like little undercurrents in the show with Eleanor, possibly, that you could reasonably say that she's attracted to Tahani romantically. And so there's a lot of good fun that comes from that ship. And then the actress that plays Tahani is also very good natured about it, but I don't really see it downplaying Eleanor's feelings for Chidi in any way, or making Chidi out to be like a bad person in the way of their ship. So it's just all like really good fun. And I think that, you know, when you do have, again, like when you have actors and actresses that are good natured about it, then you don't get the kind of nastiness in between fandoms. So it's like, I feel like it's largely why people didn't have a problem with Malice Zhao being brought in as Linda, other than the whole Barry taking Wally's life and dating her. People didn't have a problem with Malice, the actress, because she shipped her ship, but she also respected the narrative. And I think that's very important in getting good dynamics within the fandom as well. So
yeah, I mean, I agree with all of this. I think my first fan in shipping, I guess, was like Neville and Luna from Harry Potter, because like they were never a thing in the books. And then they did make them a thing in the movie, like the last movie. But it was just like fun because they were two very eccentric characters, and I think that that made a lot of sense, so that was always fun when people wrote books about them. But, I mean, I personally find fanon shipping very interesting because, for me personally, I usually tend to not ship non-canon couples, but I will say that I enjoy a good fanon ship occasionally, so long as it's just for fun, you know? So my first thought is always how the Star Trek fandom, or the new, at least like the 2000, from the 2009 film, always tend to pair up, like, Kirk and Spock for obvious reasons, so long as Uhura isn't being disrespected. Then there's, like, Uhura-Kirk, so long as Spock is being respected, it's fine. And then I've read, like, stuff that contains all three. And they usually, like, involve three of them, two of them, or whatever, but the stuff I've come across has been fairly, like, respectful, no bashing, you know. And I agree with Jess, I also enjoy Barry and Kara as a platonic ship because they're also, like, the only male-female friendship within DCTV on the CW that's focused upon and strictly a friendship with no romantic feelings on either side. So that's always refreshing and fun.
Yeah, I think that one way that fanon shipping can be really great is when it's used to explore characters that you don't really get a chance to get to know on screen. Because, like, our easiest way into a character is by shipping them for whatever reason, which is also why it's ironic when people say, like, oh, I just feel like she's not developed enough and therefore I don't want her with the main guy, because that's usually how characters get development. But anyway.
Thank you. Because people always forget that shit. It's like, but why are they getting a love story? Shut up, because that's how that means that they're important, okay?
So for example, like, people were really attached to Leonard Snart, and so there's shipping of Leonard with everyone, you know? There's a lot of Barry, there's a lot of Mick, etc. So, like, I think that that's always all fun and game. Like, if that's great, like, you write your fic, you know, as long as you're not, don't put it in my tag, and don't trash
that
day. Yeah, but, and then it's all great, because, like, you can explore characters that you want to get to know better in ships that you find fun, and I think that's awesome. Like, you guys, obviously, I also like Barry and Kara's friendship, I like Barry and Felicity's friendship, and I like fanfics that connect their ships, you know, with that friendship. I wish that there was a dynamic between Iris and Oliver, you know? Not that I'm shipping it romantically in any way, but, like, something more than just Iris thinking that he has nice arms would be great to me. I would love to know what Oliver thinks of Iris, you know?
Yeah, and, like, so it's unrealistic that he never hit on her, to be honest.
I don't know if that's unrealistic, but
it's Oliver. I don't know.
I'm not saying he doesn't respect her, but that we don't get to see how he respects her. He doesn't talk about, you know, what he thinks of her, even in relation to Barry. But anyway, and of course, I think there are so many ways that Supercore is a great fanon ship because it stimulates investment in the series, even if it isn't a canon relationship, because that friendship is canon. You know, when you see all the things that you are seeing are really happening on screen, you're just interpreting it differently than they're interpreting it, but it's still as valid, as significant of a dynamic. So in that sense, there's also the good side of fanon shipping. And then you've got a crew like Legends, right, where you can really just put anyone together. And there's no... I've been seeing a lot of Nate Wally, you know? And that's not something I would have ever thought of. But, you know, if you like that dynamic, then, you know, by all means, enjoy yourself. So yeah, I think that there's really a lot of healthy ways to explore things that you want to see. Like, for example, this is totally off the wall, like, not at all related to DCTV. But there is Les Mis. I don't know if you guys have heard of this musical book, 300 miniseries, etc. But there is a very, very large segment of, it's quite a thriving fandom, considering that this is like a 200-year-old book. And the musical has also been around for, you know, over 3 decades now. But anyway, Enjolras and Grantaire is like the most popular ship in the Les Mis fandom. And you're like, well, who the fuck are Enjolras and Grantaire? They are two characters in the group of Les Amis, like the friends that Marius makes when he's not mooning over Cosette. And Enjolras is like one of the few characters that seems to be like, they never say anything about his, you know, other than he's devoted to the revolution. Right, he doesn't have a love life, he's devoted to revolution. So you can either read him as asexual, which I do, for my own personal reasons, or you could see him as, like, you know, a lot of people see him having, like, a homoerotic or a homosexual bond with Rantaire, who is, like, the drunkard of the group, but, like, he's only there because he respects Enjolras so much. And so he even, like, they even die together because, like, you know, Rantaire could just fucking leave because he doesn't really believe in the cause, but he doesn't leave because Enjolras is there, so they die together. Anyway, there's so much fucking fanfic about this ship, but in doing so, all of those characters, like, they flesh out all the characters that are in that storyline to, like, the nth degree. Like, you have, like, novel-length fanfics written about these two dudes being in love, but it's done in a way that really, like, brings out everything that, you know, people care about when they read that story, you know, about the whole idea of revolution. And there's so much, like, I've never seen so many AUs, like, modern day Les Mis, and, like, you know, bringing in, like, well, what if it's, like, you know, racial challenges in the US, or what if it's, like, a different revolution, you know, whatever. Like, very few people are like, let's write about France in the 17 whatever, you know, the June Rebellion, whatever you want to call it. So yeah, that's also another way that I think that fan and shipping can be really useful. It really helps people hone their own talents and, like, their own world building.
For fan and shipping, like, the good thing, like, there are some shows that have fun multi-shipping their characters on their own, like The Magicians. And I think The Magicians started out as kind of trying to fit into that one OTP per character, and then they kind of grew out of that and it kind of opened up their world a lot. So there are shows like that that like to play with all of their characters, and everybody gets fed and no one starves in that fandom, because, you know, if it's not your ship right now, just wait a couple minutes and then it'll be your ship, you know, the next time or something like that. I think the DC TV shows are a little bit more monogamous with their shipping, and so some characters don't even get to interact with other characters that much. And so fan and shipping is a way of opening up those worlds more and exploring those dynamics that you don't normally get to see, like, on screen. So,
yeah, I agree. I think you guys hit the nail on the head. You know, it's like, there was, I don't remember what fic it was, but it was like involved all the Arrowverse characters. And there are some that I'm like, I got to like that I don't really like in the shows, because they were all, like, interacting with each other, and the ships expanded on, like, all the friendships and the world building, and it was just great. So it's always nice to see that without, you know, writing a fic where you're, like, trying to murder the other person to make your ship rise or whatever.
Speaking of that.
Yes, moving into that, the bad. Putting the protagonist slash hero on a pedestal, which leads to the erasure and or bashing of the canon love interest based on his or her job, appearance, personality, etc. What examples would you provide about that, and how fandoms have created, like, a bad space for shipping?
Yeah, I think when you start to get into the bad side of fan and shipping, this is where fandoms start getting, like, imaginative with their excuses, and they play fast and loose with the laws of attraction and quote-unquote chemistry to make up reasons why their fave story is more appropriate choice for the protagonist and what the writers chose to do and how they chose to write their characters. So, like, within the DC TV fandom, the Oliver Felicity fandom, they used to, and probably still do, they tore into Laurel and Katie Cassidy a lot to reimagine Laurel as this kind of, like, mean girl and undeserving of Oliver's love, which, Katie Cassidy aside, because, you know, she's not my favorite person for other reasons not show-related, but they went into her pretty hard, like, conspiracy theories and, you know, attacking her. And this is not, like, the whole fandom, but certain crazy people in particular. And I think that kind of starts to kind of cross the line into bad. Like, you're taking this a little bit too further into a not great place. And even after Oliver and Felicity actually got together, Laurel still continued to be, like, a threat as long as she was alive. So that didn't, Oliver and Felicity happening didn't change anything about how Laurel was treated. Even though Laurel, like, it was clear in the narrative, there's a narrative shift that Laurel didn't care anything about Oliver and Felicity being together was supportive of that relationship. It didn't really change how fandom perceived her, largely how she was perceived in fandom. With Kara and the Femme Slash shippers on Supergirl, like Supercore is a great fandom ship, but the bad thing that kind of bothers me is when they start demonizing James, whether he's with Kara or he's with Lena, because he is a man with a penis, and that means he's in the way. James is not written as a predatory douche or any of the other lists of, like, dirty adjectives that a lot of people in fandom, and not just Supercore fandom, but even in general, have attributed to him. But he only gets this treatment when he's being romantically linked to first Kara and now Lena. So season two, you would think that he was kind of like the darling of the show, because that hashtag James deserved better was and that was coincidentally the only season that he wasn't like romantically linked to a woman. So he was everybody's favorite. Like, I've never seen so many James stands in my life. And it's not like the Supergirl writers are baiting LGBT viewers and denying them of rep at all, because there's still, you still have Maggie, you still have Sanders, and that kind of coming of age story. So it's not like no one's getting anything. Like, there's still like a story there for people that want that representation on Supergirl that have it. It's just not with the couple. It's not with the hero. And I think that's when it gets back into the hero's front of the pedestal. So the hero is the most important person in the show, which means that whoever the hero loves is also worth the most. Yeah. And fandom really didn't seem to think that James was worthy of Kara's love then. And they don't really seem to think that, and since they do think that Lena is just worthy of Kara's love now, they don't like that James is in the way of that either, so he has to go. And then you see this a lot in kind of fan fiction as well, because the hero or the protagonist is the main person, the one that they care the most about is also like the most important. And so in fan fiction, when they're not getting that on screen, a lot of people try to fix that in their fan fiction. And so, for example, Iris on The Flash and West Allen, a lot of the fanfics that wind up in West Allen tag that are not actually West Allen that really annoy me are the ones that, you know, Iris is often rewritten or reimagined as either the bitchy mean girl dead so that Caitlin can raise her kids. Like, really 100% supportive of her, like, 100% brother dating someone that's not her. So all of the things that they try to fix what they think is wrong with the narrative on the show to contort that into something that they agree with in, like, fan fiction. And I don't really like, again, like, you're going into, like, the bad side of it. When you don't like the canon ship, that's fine. You like your side ship, whatever. But reimagining something about the love interest, like her personality, that she's a bitchy mean girl, that she thought of Barry as a brother and only her brother, that she was emotionally abusive to Barry, all that shit that does not exist on the show. When you try to incorporate that in the fan fiction, it just goes from something that's not fun to something that's a little bit more shady and not great. Yeah, like, the only when the person that protagonist favors is not who you want them to, the only way to lift up your fave is to devalue, like, the chosen one, quote-unquote. Usually by claiming that the protagonist has been manipulated or misled, and we see that a lot in people's excuses of why they can't like Iris or they don't like Iris with Barry.
I agree about, well, for me, super core shippers are fine if they stay in their lane, which a lot of them do not.
Yeah.
What I don't like seeing is them hating on James, like you said, so to try to justify their ship. And then it's, well, this is more the ugly section, but, like, especially when Kara and Lena have never been a canon couple, like, I don't understand why you have to trash a character to, like, if you have to trash a character to me to make your ship rise, then obviously your ship isn't all that to begin with, because that's what you have to do to get it, you know, going. So if, like, you're going to write fics about this, you know, a side ship or whatever that doesn't exist in canon, why not just create a different scenario? Make an alternate universe. Set it in the future. You don't have to, like,
other character.
What was that?
It's like, don't even write about that character. Right. Why are you focused on this other character when you have everything in your own little world.
Exactly. Like, if it wasn't, if they were truly happy with their little side thing, then they wouldn't feel the need to be threatened by this character, even in fanfiction, for example. And then, like, outside of DCTV, one of the first bad fanon shipping experiences I always think of is, like, Harry Hermione shippers, which they still make my blood boil. I'm sorry for anybody who likes them as a couple. book people, and there were tons of book people prior to the movies. Who shipped Harry and Hermione.
I was going to say, I feel like Harry and Hermione came from the movies, really.
Yeah, well, no, there were plenty of book people who shipped them.
Arguments?
Yeah.
And people, like, from the book forums, like, with people saying that Ron was unworthy of love from anybody.
Oh my god.
So they were called Harmony Shippers. Harmony Ship sank, okay. So they would completely erase Ron from the narrative. Like Jess said, they would call him, you know, they would call him stupid, and they would undermine him in general and say that he wasn't a good friend to Harry, and he doesn't deserve Hermione, and blah, blah, blah. So I guess it's like the opposite, because it was the male being erased here, but it got so bad that it bled into the movies. I'm looking at you, Steve Kloves. The screenwriter and certain fans, they couldn't fathom a world in which the leading female character didn't end up with the leading male character, even though, at least in the books, that was implied as early as the end of the second book, and then later confirmed that Ron and Hermione were the canon ship, even above Harry and Ginny, and Harry is like the male protagonist, you know? And then you have like the Star Wars fandom, who loves to ship Rey and Kylo together, and a lot of those people erase Finn. Or they elevate Kylo to the point of him being, like, a worthy human being, worthy of sympathy, and then bash Finn for, like, the smallest thing and say that, you know, him and Rey are just, I'm sure they say, like, siblings or whatever, or they just don't mention him at all, or they just hate on him, even though it's more implied in the movies that Rey and Finn could potentially have something going on. But, like, their love of Kylo makes them hate Finn, because they know he's like a threat.
Yeah, because Rey is the lead, is the mm-hmm. protagonist, and so even though, you know, their fave is coming up with a severe loss of points from the start, and so in order to get him like closer up to being like the one, or you know, acceptable, they have to bring Finn down to do that. And then even with Harry Potter, like the Harry as a protagonist, the person that he was closest to, the person that he probably loved the most out of all his friends was Ron. Mm-hmm. So obviously Ron was the one that needed to be brought down several pegs to either bring up Hermione or to bring up Draco. Because Draco Harry is like the biggest
flash
fan, even above like Harry and Ron. So.
But it just amazes me because for like, you're right, Ron was the most important person to Harry. Like this kid spent his summers at Ron Weasley's home, practically was adopted into his family, and people couldn't take the fact that Ron was a good guy overall. Like, everything, every insecurity he might have felt, they elevated that, you know, tenfold, so.
It's very prevalent, like, what you guys are talking about, the warping of a character's canon characteristics in order to make room for your fandomship, as if you can't enjoy your ship in isolation from canon. And I think that comes from like the need to feel justified by what the writers have done, and often that is not the case. You like your ship for whatever reason, but that doesn't mean that what you have on screen or on paper is wrong, is bad. Like, I saw a tweet recently, like a little, you know, that meme, the SpongeBob meme, where it's like one of them, like, TV show writers, professional TV show writers was the good one, and then, like, fanfic writers was the bad one. And I was like, that's not in any way true. It's just because when you don't get what you want from the TV show, and then you find a fanfic writer that gives it to you, you think that's better. But it's not, you know, it doesn't make it better all the time. Obviously, you don't like a fanfic writer that writes a different ship from the one you like, or the one that kills off your fave in their fanfic. So it's all the need to have your your preference be the real preference. And that shouldn't have to be the case. And just to bring it to DCTV and, you know, do the devil's advocate, even though the devil doesn't need an advocate, just like how people would trash Laurel and Katie unnecessarily when Lorever was the canon ship in favor of Olicity, now that Olicity is the canon ship, people will go out of their way to try to bring down Felicity and to make Olicity sound much worse than it is. You know what I mean? And we'll take it to the, you know, like, and it's like a reaction. Like, I'm doing this because you did this to me. But that doesn't make how you're treating Felicity as a female character or how you're treating Emily as an actress somehow better. You're still just using the same tactics that were used to prove whatever your point is, whether you really wanted Lorever to happen or you just wanted, I don't know, Oliver to just fuck off and do whatever. But yeah, it's like, just because you don't like a ship or you don't think it's well done doesn't mean that usually the female character, but in Ron's case, and I would argue that it's because Ron has characteristics that are usually associated with female characters. Like the fact that he provides family for Harry and the fact that he's sort of seen as the emotional support part of the team is why people are so it's so easy for people to tear him down in favor of, like, rather than tear Hermione down.
But, and you see it in the movies too in this case, because you have all of Ron's greatest lines in the books are relegated to Hermione saying them. So, like, he gets shoved to the side, sitting in his little corner. There's literally a scene where he's sitting in the corner so that, you know, Hermione and Harry can have their moment. And in terms of DCTV, one of the closest things I can think of is, like, when people who shipped Chloe and Clark together on Smallville would try to change reimagine Chloe as the real Lois Lane.
Yeah.
So they couldn't, because they knew who Lois Lane was and how important she was to the narrative, that they would try to twist her importance and give that importance to Chloe so that they can erase her from her storyline. And there are some people who do that with Iris too, that Caitlin is the quote-unquote real Iris.
She's white and she wears a watch. Like the comics. And I think for, like, Olicity and Oliver and Felicity as well, it wasn't just that if you don't like Laurel in the ship with Oliver, that's fine. A lot of people didn't like Laurel in the ship with Oliver, and that's how you got Olicity in the first place, becoming canon on the show. But just because you don't like a certain character in a ship does not mean that that character is just irredeemable and has no kind of worth whatsoever. I even like Superchorus. I really like Superchorus as a ship, but I don't like the side effect of having to devalue James as a character when that's not how he's written on the show. And then also, like, it's kind of for, you know, the writers intentionally put them together. Like, why would the writers put their hero or their protagonist with someone that is that awful and not play it out that way?
Exactly. Which leads us into the ugly part of shipping. When you start believing your own fan fiction, and this goes from fanon shipping to crack shipping. So, like, the entitlement of fandoms to make their ship real because they so dislike what the writers are doing on their own shows that they want their own narrative to replace what's actually being given to them, and how that reflects on certain segments of the audience's views or their views of the relationships and the hierarchy in the real world. So what are some examples of the ugly sides of shipping?
Yeah, I think this, like, when you think of, like, the ugly side of fan shipping, it's not just that you believe your own fan fiction, you do. It's like you subvert the actual narrative, so you think that, like, the writers are actually sending you, like, coded messages through the screen that your story is the real story. That's when you get into, like, crack shipping. And, you know, again, like, I love Supercore, but the ugly side of it is, like, harassing the writers for being homophobic by saying that they're oppressing or abusing Lena by putting her with James instead of putting her with Kara. When it's not canon that they have romantic feelings for each other. And it could be later on, but at the moment, you know, both Lena's love interests on the show have been men. Robbie, the guy that plays Robbie, that I can't think of his name because I'm still bad with names. When he guest starred, that was her ex-boyfriend, and now she was into James. And when she was into James, she pursued James. So she is an assertive person when she likes somebody. So I would assume that if she does develop romantic feelings for Kara, then you would see her assert those. But since she hasn't so far, and she could come out as bi later on, but, you know, narratively in the story right now, she's just into men at this point. So the writers aren't being homophobic by forcing her to be with James. Like, Lena wanted to be with James. And again, like, you still have, I think someone on the writer's staff is actually lesbian, and her writing of Maggie's story was reflective of her coming out story. So it's not like you're being denied representation. It might not be the pairing that you want, but I think it's a little bit overboard to call the writers homophobic because they won't make super core canon. But the one in the DCTV verse that really is the definition of crack shipping, it's the show that I'm closest to. So of course it's The Flash, and of course it's like Snowberry, like their entire existence, pretty much. And I'm sure there are some people that aren't this way, like a few, but just an overwhelming amount of them literally rewrite the narrative and everything to fit that Barry and Caitlin is the secret love story of the show. And they actually, like, down to the fact that, oh, you know, they both wore gray in this scene, so the production is sending us a coded message that they're staying with us in solidarity against the social justice warrior that Barry and Iris have to be together, you know? And it's to the point that over the seasons, and I didn't even mind Barry and Caitlin interacting and having, like, a friendship in season one, and, like, her counseling him on his feelings for Iris and all that kind of stuff, and them having, like, scenes together. But it just got to the point where literally I could, like, telegraph, you know, Barry standing with Iris and it's snowing outside. I'm like, oh, look, they're going to make that a moment. And they did. They're like, oh, he said it's snowing outside. You must be thinking about Caitlin. I'm like, come on. And they think that writers are, like, literally put that in just to, like, wink and nod at them that, you know, this is what we're really doing. And that's just kind of, when you get that delusional, you kind of have to step back and reevaluate yourself or something.
What I find most entertaining about this, though, is, like, you are insulting the writers by trying to harass them to the point where you want your ship written into a narrative when it was never written in to begin with. It's like, you dislike something so much. Why are you watching? And B, like, you're literally in the writer's tags hating on something that they spend a lot of time on. So if they love something and you hate it...
If it was that secret of a narrative or that was their real intention, there would be some more obvious signs. You shouldn't have to look so hard to find what the actual point of the story. And, like, a lot of people's like, well, you know, Barry and Iris are so expected, so it's, like, boring. You know, what we, in our game from earlier, Krypton, you know, you're not supposed to... It's not a game of Clue to figure out what the plot is. It shouldn't be that hard. And when you are just, like, rewriting the entire narrative and trying to, like, twist into the most impossible interpretation, especially when it comes to Iris and her characterization, like, why would the writers who clearly love Barry, why would they do that intentionally and make her this awful person intentionally and then go through with them getting married and continuing on with this plot if that's not the actual story of the show? The TV doesn't really work that way. Television is a business. So if something's not working, then they would change it. And then, like, TV shows do that all the time. Like, you can, Supergirl changed from James when they decided it was not working and put her with Mon-El for better or for worse, and they broke that up. You've got Arrow. Arrow changed from their canon ship, which was Laurel and Oliver, to Oliver and Felicity because they found something that they thought that worked better. This Is Us on NBC. Kevin and his rotating door of love interests trying to figure out something that sticks for him. Like, it wasn't working. They didn't keep it. They changed it. So obviously, like, writers are not opposed to changing up a narrative for a better pairing that works with their story or works with their chemistry. So 4 seasons in, if nothing is changing and they've still been building on the same relationship that they've been building on, maybe that's the actual fucking relationship of the show, people. And it's not going to change.
That reminds me of The 100. Season 5, and Bellamy and Clark is still not a thing. and yet, people really, honestly, truly believe that that's where it's going, even though everyone stated it from the writers to the cast, and the story has never gone there yet. So it's like, I guess it could be the literal slowest slow burn in the history of television, or it's just not what they want to do.
Listen, yeah. I started watching The 100 thinking that Bellamy and Clark were a thing, and I'm certain that some people entered The Flash thinking, oh my god, you know, Barry and Caitlin get together. But then I'm watching the show, I'm like, what? Like, and then I go online to discover they're not a ship. Bellamy and Clark have never been a ship. They don't have anything going on, and it's him and Raven. So it's also interesting that they're trying to erase a woman of color out of her narrative, also to try to put the two white people together.
Yeah, although to be fair, and I haven't watched The 100, so I can't say for sure, like, Raven and Bellamy, I was about to call him Bellark, slept together in the first and, but then it's like, then they haven't been together since, but I think that from what I've read, you do see some clear signs of, like, sexual tension, etc. Mm-hmm. So that would be a literal slow burn, but that's just not the slow burn they want. Because they want Bellamy to be elevated via Clark, or vice versa, because Clark's original ship was killed off, because people fucking hated him, and, you know, even when you are the lead of your own show, if your ship gets killed off, you're gonna lose importance, because there isn't a man to attach you to. And then she was with Lexa, and Lexa was killed off, which again shows them not valuing Clark on her own. So it's like, how do we get Clark to be number one? Bellamy.
Yeah. It's kind of, for me, again, just, you know, since, like, writers are not that subtle when they're looking to make stuff happen, because you don't want it to be subtle. You want people to be invested in what you're trying to do. So they're going to give you, like, obvious signs of what's going on, and for, you know, they're not going to write an imperfect love interest and then not show that they're being imperfect, or that they are imperfect, not present it that way. And they're not going to continue to do that for seasons on end and just continue to let your protagonist, quote unquote, suffer with this imperfect person, because it's not the person that you want. The person that you want has been there all along. It's not like, you know, this person hasn't been introduced yet, and they come in, and then the protagonist realizes the error of their shipping ways and switches to this new person. This person has been there from, like, the beginning, and is still there, and nothing's happening there. And so the only thing that you're doing is giving yourself, like, hypertension over fictional characters. Like, people, like, when you call them out on this, like, they're fictional characters, so why are you so mad, Becky? Like, why are you sending calls to the CW?
And also, what's like, amazing, too, if you think about it, is, like, A, you're right, they're fictional characters, why are you so stressed? And B, if you truly love this female character that you claim to say you love, why the fuck would you want her to be with a guy who obviously doesn't love her? Like, I don't understand. I don't. So, like, in my lovely Harry Potter continuing example is, well, in this case, Ron. So, like, Ron's being erased from the narrative, right? So the ugly part of it is, on screen, he was also erased from the narrative. They demeaned him. They made him out to be a terrible person, unworthy of love, the butt of a joke. And these are just fans, and, you know, in general. And the movies ruined his image for the sake of a relationship. Why? Because the screenwriter for the majority of the films literally had to ask J.K. Rowling whether he thought that Harry and Hermione were endgame. Like, this is what he actually thought. And to this day, I'm still mad at him.
How can you let someone, like, who obviously doesn't understand what's going on, right? I was fucking 11. I was Harry's age when I started reading Harry Potter. And I could tell by the middle of book two that Hermione and Ron were endgame. Because when she was in the hospital, when she was petrified, and he was so worried, I was like, that's the shit.
Yes.
Not that hard. It's not rocket science.
But they're, like, convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt that Harry and Hermione were endgame. Like, the entire season, or the entire series, rather, not season. So, like, they bashed Ron, they bashed Ginny, they bashed Ron and Hermione as a ship, they bashed Harry and Ginny as a ship, even though Harry, it was clear later on that that's who he wanted to be with, because they were considered threats. And then when they'd argue that Hermione was too good for Ron, or said that the romance came too suddenly, like, oh my god, it happened too fast, like we've heard so many times for actual canon ships, even though it was apparent, like Tati said, since the, at least the third book, if you're really paying attention, or not paying attention, that's where the story was going, and it was confirmed by the author. Like, there was absolutely no evidence in canon that Harry and Hermione ever had feelings for each other. And the seventh book, you know, yeah, he called her his sister, and fans still weren't convinced that they that they were not going to end up together. So, like, it pisses me off that someone who was basically a fan and is now in a position of power doesn't understand the characters, and he was like the walking example of how delusion and the incapability to understand narratives can make you entitled to the point that you try to write your non-existent ship on screen.
And you know who else pisses off? The OG authors of the stories, who are protective of the stories that they've written. And so, like, we are not the first to angrily attack writers who are not going in the ship direction that we want, and it usually fails. People always point to Elicity for success, but they forget that the second that Emily walked in for her one-off episode, they liked her so much they brought her back. They had already made her a regular before anyone saw her to begin with. So it's not the same thing. They didn't just give in to your, you know, screeches about how she is his Girl Friday. They were already thinking that on their own. If they hadn't decided to do Legends of Tomorrow with Katie Lotz, I'm not convinced that they would have given, you know, done Elicity. They might have just stayed with that scenario. Yeah. But because they liked Katie Lotz so much, they wanted to give her their own show, they went on from that.
And I think going back to Harry Potter, like, I didn't even care about Harry and Ginny, to be honest. Like, Ron Hermione was my ship.
Did anyone, though?
I think, like, the only reason, honestly, that he ended up with Ginny was because Ginny was closest to Ron, and Ron was closest to Harry. Mm-hmm. So, like, that just shows you how important Ron was to Harry, that it's Ron's sister that he eventually, like, falls in love with. Which, if he could have fell in love with Ron, I'd be probably, you know,
whatever. Right, like, it was so interesting to me that of the slash ships in the Harry Potter world, it was more Draco Harry versus, like, Ron Harry, because, like, you would think that that would be more more of a thing, but it wasn't.
You know, people really don't like healthy relationships.
Apparently not. Like, Harry Draco was the Rey Kylo back in the day.
Yeah. That's true. DCTV example, when crack shippers go wrong, is going back to Twisted again with Joe and Danny shippers being extremely toxic, extremely, like, just spewing vitriol all over Facebook and everything. And I scratched the surface of that fandom, so I don't really know how deep it went, but attacking, like, Kylie Bunbury, who played Lacey, who Danny was actually interested in, and the show actually gave in to crack shippers, and then their show tanked, and they got canceled. So, moral of the story, don't do crack. Crack is whack.
But no, taking it all the way back, because what reminds me of Harry Potter and the fact that Harry clearly only got with Ginny because that was the closest he could get to Ron, is Little Women, which I've brought up a billion times. But, like, that's how long people have been angrily sending things to the writers. And what did she do? She was like, I wanted Joe to be single, but since y'all won't leave me the fuck alone, I'm gonna have her marry Professor Bear, this random German dude, who's gonna totally change Joe's storyline just to fuck you over. So, don't get mad at the writers, because they'll get mad at you back. For that reason, I mean, like, obviously, if you have constructive criticism, that's great. But when you're just like, I want a different story, she'll be like, here's this other fucking story that you really don't want.
Yeah, and like you guys were saying for DCTV and just mentioned, like, Snowberry, but I'll add on to that by saying, since you went over all the great points, is that the sense of entitlement is so strong that when they tweet writers, or they'll claim they'll call the CW, and they'll start online petitions where, like, 11 people will sign, and they legitimately have it in their heads that they were promised a ship, which has never been the case, not by any writer, producer, or within the narrative itself, and, like, the insult that you're throwing the writer's way because you don't like their story, it's like, go fucking watch something else. They clearly aren't watching the same show. But my favorite has to be, like, the conspiracy theory about the costume department.
Yeah.
And, like, they even twist ratings and exaggerate how many people dislike Iris, for example, in order to claim the show is going down the drain because of West Allen when it's clearly not. And, like, going back to, like, Smallville, how they used to trash Lois because they wanted Chloe to be the primary interest. So Chloe fans back then were what Felicity fans are now. So that's why Felicity fans think that they've won, right? Because this is the story that Chloe, you know, quote unquote, should have gotten. And they would trash Lois, and they believed that Chloe was Clark's one true love, even though in the narrative that was never apparent. And the one time that there was like a ship tease, it was like in Lex's head. So it's just a bunch of nonsense.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that gets me the most is when people get the entitlement, they're saying that they were promised something that was never the narrative to begin with. And it would be one thing if the narrative started one way and it wasn't going the way that the writers wanted, so the writers decided to change. But you were never promised from the beginning to have Barry and Caitlin end up together. Like, it was very clearly stated in the pilot, in the beginning, in the comics, in the original source material, where the ship was supposed to go. So you weren't promised shit. So this is not like a choose-your-own-adventure story. You don't get to, like... This is not a collective writing process with you in the writer's room where you can just get them to change shit. Like, they have a process in what they're doing. And if money, as in advertising and stuff, wasn't going their way, they would have changed long before now. So, obviously, they're not worried about ratings and people liking the story. Because, obviously, enough people like the story that they haven't changed it. So, either, you know, get with the program, or if it's that bad... Stick in your little fan fiction bubble outside of my tag and live your life.
Exactly. And again, like, love yourselves. And if you do claim to love a character, ship her with someone else who actually cares about her.
That's the other thing that I like, that I don't like, is because when they do pretend to advocate for their quote unquote character and claim that it's not about shipping, they just want their character to have more development, they can't do it without bringing in the love interest that they claim not to care about. So, like, when people, a lot of times when we have, like, trends and stuff for Iris and what we want to see for her, we can come up with a bunch of different things that are completely Iris-focused, Iris-related, but you've got, when people try to do that for Caitlin, a lot of the times, like, there's maybe, like, four or five people that I actually care about and write stuff for, I want to see this for Caitlin, da, 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 da. But then you've got like a million other people, not a million, because there's not that many of them, but other people that can't keep Iris out of their mouth to promote their character. And everything that Caitlin has gotten, for example, like what I was saying in her Flash Time in 15, when she did get like a good nugget of development between her and her Killer Frost side, people were immediately attaching that to Barry. It was like, well, if you want her to be a more developed character because you love her as a character, why are you taking this from her and giving it to your ship because you still are on that thing that your ship is going to happen because da-da-da-da.
Yeah, because, so, like, secretly, you know, they know the hierarchy and they know it's that they dislike Iris, but yeah, more importantly, they dislike her because they want a white woman in her place, and they know that Barry's at the top of that hierarchy, so they can't not hate Iris because she is what they want. Like, even when these twist stories, they still use the West Allen storyline, but they just plop Caitlin in there because even though they claim it's cliche, it's not. Or, I mean, even if it is, yeah, they still want it because that's what they truly want. They want that narrative. They don't want it for that woman.
Whether it is like a racialized, like bringing in like the outside views and how this reflects on the outside world, whether it be a racial bias where you can't imagine a woman of color or a black woman being the focus of love, and so you have to somehow make that make sense in your head, which turns the whole narrative upside down, and, you know, why can't this relatively developed character that has her own stuff, why can't she be the center of attention? And it doesn't even have to be like a racial bias, because like Laurel's a white woman, she still got shit on. And so, and that's like a different kind of dynamic, because Felicity is kind of like the nerd girl and Laurel was not nerd. So, you know, you still get, you know, the things, insecurities from the outside world and people's past and wanting to feel like the only one, bleeding into how they reimagine characters in the show to kind of make it make sense in their head why the person that they like should be with be the most desirable and not this other person.
Yep.
And that also promotes, like, sexism in general, because it's like women can't, there's still that fight to the top, right? So it's like you're not the leading female, people will try to make you the leading female and you can't be anything else. Otherwise, they know that you're not important, unfortunately.
Or like bringing back in Harry Potter, Hermione is obviously making the wrong choice because she's not attracted to the top lead male. So obviously something is wrong because she went with Ron and not with Harry.
Yep.
That's not what, like, the alpha male, you don't go for the beta or whatever.
That's the truth. And this has been a PSA. The ship you want, just don't get crazy about it.
If you have thoughts, then, you know, you can always contact us and let us know your frustrations about ugly side of fan and shipping, crack shipping.
Do you agree?
Please
do.
Disagree? Let us know anyway.
If we have offended you, let us know why.
Yes.
If you're a Harry and Hermione shipper from the movies, I apologize. I get it, but no. No, no, you're right. I don't. I'm still bitter. All right. You have been listening to the Ladies of the Gumption. Once again, you can hit us up on Twitter at DCTVGumption. Email us your lovely long emails at ladieswgumption@gmail.com or listen to us and leave us a review on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. We will see you next week.